Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now, interestingly enough, the head of the Democratic National Committee, the first one, was Tom Kaine. Tim Kaine was head of the Democratic National Committee. He has been rewarded. He was her vice president. After that, you had Schultz Wasserman. So she was. So these are Clinton people who had control of the Democratic National Committee. Now, what they should have been doing, of course, is what the National Party does. They go out and they make sure that they get money raised for governors, for House of Representatives, for senators. They did some of that, but they were mainly concerned with the election of 2012 and the election of Hillary in 2016. And at the end of 2016, when 2015, instead of throwing it open for all comers, Bill Clinton went around personally and told people, Hillary Clinton is inevitable. Don't even think about running. She is inevitable. Now, one key person she told, just to cite one example, is the former Duval Patrick. Cite him as one example. He was the governor of Massachusetts, two-term governor of Massachusetts. He's an African-American. Mm-hmm. He is an African-American in a state that has a very low proportion of African-Americans, so he knows how to appeal to white voters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he was a candidate. He gave a very strong keynote address in 2012. So he was right in line. Bill Clinton went to him and said, don't think about it, running. Now, he had a chit to him, and you haven't heard this anywhere, and I haven't even said it publicly. But the chit that he owed Bill Clinton was this. Lonnie Guinier, you may recall, went up for that position of the Attorney General?
She ultimately didn't get the position.
But the position that she did not get, Duval Patrick got it in the Clinton administration. You see, so Duval Patrick owed him, so he called his chit on him. All right. Not only did he call his chit on him, said, don't think about running. Hillary is inevitable. He got him a job at Bain Capital, big, high-paying job. Bain Capital was founded by Mitt Romney in Boston. And that's where he is now. And so he got him out of the way. And there were others who did not run for that very reason. Okay? And as a result, so she was made the inevitable. In fact, Duval Patrick was quoted in the paper there saying that he did not like the point that Bill Clinton was telling people that Hillary was inevitable. So he, this is my point. It was his point as
well. Was that after the fact he said that or during?
During the fact, you know, he said he thought it was a mistake. And by the way, I talked this over with, at the NABJ convention in December, I talked it over with David Plouffe, who he agreed with me. He was also the guy who engineered the election of Duval Patrick in Massachusetts. And Axelrod, they're very important in getting him elected. And he said, yes, he said, this guy is an incredible campaigner. All right, Hillary is not. And he said it would have been very interesting if he had run.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 6th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our fifth study session on the late Gwen Ifill. Her book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Book was published in 2009. Actually, it was published on the day President Obama was inaugurated. I saw that specific detail about the date as I was reading more information about the book this week. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was the legend, Mr. Les Payne. We always talk about the importance of black journalists. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, also the founder of the National Association of Black Journalists. He was a guest on Bill Roden's program, Brothers on Sports, just within the last couple days. I think that is, if not their most recent, one of their most recent programs. They spent almost 2 hours talking about a range of subjects, but specifically, he was talking about Deval Patrick in that clip, who is going to take up a whole chapter in this week's segment of the book as one of the breakthroughs, the former two-term governor of Massachusetts. It's going to be really interesting, and particularly given what you heard there about Deval Patrick and his comments about Bill Clinton coming and telling people, you know, don't even think about running. This is all for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So, you know, bow down. And specifically, the position that Deval Patrick had in the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton is his administration. He Deval Patrick was the assistant to the attorney general under the Clinton administration. So that was the appointment that Les Payne was talking about, where I guess the offer he's saying was, hey, we hooked you up before. So now you got to pay that favor back and make sure that you do not run during the 2016 presidential election. Very interesting. And you can find those comments online where Deval Patrick said he was not pleased. And I think the term that Mr. Patrick used was this sense of inevitability, that this is Hillary Clinton's time and everybody should just bow down, get out of her way and help her run. He said that he did not think that that was a successful strategy. It should have been open for, you know, all comers, just as you heard from Mr. Payne. And he was saying this like well in advance, way before we even got to the primaries. Without further ado, we will get started. We're picking up. This is the chapter on political identity, politics and identity, chapter 9. We're kind of in the midway point. Context of white supremacy, Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, audio segment number 1.
The only thing more politically debilitating than the black enough question is the too black question. The latter is seldom asked out loud, and it is never asked by black people. It is, however, the question that can cost mainstream black candidates an election. At one town hall meeting in Pennsylvania, a white Obama supporter asked his candidate whether Hillary Clinton was speaking in code when she suggested the Illinois senator was out of touch and elitist. As a white person, this term, the way it's being used against you, isn't far from uppity, the man said. I think the Clintons are getting away with something that they must be called on. Obama dismissed the Clinton critique as mere politics. Bill Clinton, in the meantime, cried foul, asserting in a radio interview that the Obama campaign played the race card on me after he linked Obama to Jesse Jackson. I just fundamentally refuse to believe that this wasn't a part of their strategy to try to turn him into the African-American candidate, said campaign manager David Plouffe when I asked him about Clinton's remarks. I will never believe otherwise because there's too much evidence to suggest that it's true, and I think it's highly unfortunate, but it is what it is. Far more damaging to Obama's efforts to get past the racial identity issue was a videotape showing Barack Obama's Chicago pastor raging in the pulpit against injustice perpetrated by a nation he referred to at one point as the U.S. of KKKA. Few saw the full sermons. Instead, they saw an endless YouTube video loop of an angry black man appearing to blame America for 9/11 and calling on God to visit damnation on the land of the free and the home of the brave. Obama had known Wright, who officiated at his marriage, baptized his children, and blessed his house for 20 years. This was a problem, and for a time it swamped his campaign. Obama launched into a series of stuttering explanations. He had never been in church when the Reverend Jeremiah Wright said such things. Well, maybe he had. Wright was like everyone's old uncle who would say things you did not necessarily agree with. Well, Wright wasn't actually his spiritual advisor. The shifting explanations were made necessary by the subtext that polls showed was troubling white voters in particular. If Obama didn't mind belonging to a church whose slogan was unashamedly black, unapologetically Christian, was Barack Obama perhaps too black? This was dangerous terrain for a political candidate engaged in a tooth and nail struggle for every available vote. Answering that question, either incompletely or too completely, was bound to alienate somebody somewhere. Obama campaign manager Plouffe and others had detected the difficulty inherent in the Wright connection early on. Obama, in fact, had blocked Wright from delivering a public invocation at his presidential campaign announcement. The overhang is, well, you know, this may be too much for people, Plouffe told me when the first burst of Wright publicity hit the airwaves. Maybe this will prove that people really aren't ready for an African-American named Barack Obama at this moment in time. This theory demanded a test, and it occurred at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, where Obama walked into a stage crowded with U.S. flags and delivered a speech on race that received roadblock cable television coverage. At various stages in the campaign, some commentators have deemed me either too black or not black enough, he said. Wright, he argued, was a man bound by his past, someone who considered the nation's racial dilemmas to be static, essentially unfixable. By characterizing Wright in this way, Obama distanced himself from the pastor without alienating black churchgoers. And he used the address to cast himself as the biracial bridge spanning the nation's, quote, racial stalemate. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents, he told a multiracial audience in Philadelphia. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional candidate, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many we are truly one. Obama had not wanted to give a race speech, but I think in our case we really didn't have an option, Plouffe said. Our candidacy could have been consumed by this. So when the time came, Obama told many Americans what they wanted to hear, that contrary to Wright's negative worldview, racial difference need not mean racial division. Contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle, he said. Or with a single candidacy, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. At first, the speech appeared a masterstroke, what the New York Times called his profile in courage. He talked to us as though we were adults, the comedian Jon Stewart said with mock astonishment on his nightly news parody, The Daily Show. Maybe we'll get a little bit further in the dialogue on race, Esther Johns, a college administrator in Washington State, told the New York Times. The guilt factor may be lowered a little bit because Obama made it right to be white and still love your black relatives, and to be black and still love your white relatives. Still, the Obama campaign had lingering worries, correctly so, as it turned out. We're kind of in the penalty box about this with voters, Plouffe said. I think some voters, some white voters in particular, who were thinking about shutting the door on us, opened it back up after the speech. They haven't managed to walk on through yet. Indeed, Wright did not go away. He was back in a matter of weeks in a trio of public appearances on PBS, in Detroit, and in Washington, D.C., that stirred up all the old doubts all over again among voters who wondered whether Obama secretly embraced Wright's radicalism. In the end, Obama was forced first to denounce Wright and then to quit his Afrocentric church entirely. Unnoticed while the cable networks and many nervous voters obsessed over Wright was a less inflammatory but still remarkable statement made by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, next to Aretha Franklin, perhaps the world's most famous black woman. No one considered Rice a radical, and because of her close association with President George W. Bush and hawkish Republicans, questions about her racial authenticity had run far deeper than Obama's for far longer. Africans and Europeans came here and founded this country together, Europeans by choice and Africans in chains, she told editors and reporters at the conservative Washington Times newspaper. That's not a very pretty reality of our founding, and I think that particular birth defect makes it hard for us to confront it, hard for us to talk about it, and hard for us to realize that it has continuing relevance for who we are today. This was not the first time Rice had been moved to address the racial identity question. In a speech she delivered to the class of 1999 as she ended her tenure as provost at Stanford, she declared that identity and history are double-edged swords. Her 8 years working for President Bush would expose her to both sides of that blade, but she seldom spoke about the conflict as openly as she did after Obama plotted out the map. She could have taken her cue from her immediate predecessor in the chief diplomat's job. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell practically dared observers to declare him race neutral. Although he too moved in many white Republican circles, he just wasn't having it. I have never let anybody believe that I'm not black, and I'm not proud of what those who went before me did, the retired general told me. I never distanced myself from the Buffalo Soldiers, from any of those guys, because I'm here because of them, and I'm not going to let youngsters forget or white people forget what we went through. So when they say, well, how can you still support affirmative action, I say, because I saw the affirmative action the other folks had for about 200 years. Every black achiever has invariably stumbled into the identity minefield, whether he or she made the choice to engage in combat or not. Because race always makes for a fraught conversation, it should come as no surprise that some version of racialized conflict would become the hallmark of a historic campaign such as Obama's. The outstanding questions remained unanswered. Will the nation's birth defect ever make it impossible for racial politics to be set aside completely? Representative Emanuel Cleaver II, a black Missouri Democrat who supported Hillary Clinton during the primary, worried that Obama's candidacy was letting white people off the racial hook. They are looking at Barack Obama and saying, this is our chance to demonstrate that we have been able to get this boogeyman called race behind us, he said. And so they are going to vote for him. Certainly, 95% of black voters and 67% of Latino voters did go for Obama in the end, outperforming John Kerry's 2004 support with both groups. Still, a persistent strain of pessimism never went away. Even when Obama was leading McCain by double digits in the polls leading up to Election Day, debates about race, some of them murmured, some of them conducted at a high decibel level, cropped up repeatedly. In early October at the New Yorker Festival, political activist Donna Brazile sliced through the musings of the four white men on stage who had been debating whether race would ultimately hold Obama back. This is a more tolerant, a more open, a more progressive society, she said with force, and yet we are having these conversations because he is biracial. He spent 9 months in the womb of a white woman. He was raised for the first 19 to 21 years by his white grandparents, and yet he got out of school and went to Harvard, and all of a sudden he's uppity and something is wrong with him. I tell my friends, you may vote against him, but don't ever put me back in the back of the bus, she continued. I'm not going to the back of the bus. I'm not going to be afraid anymore. My black skin does not make me inferior. The men on stage fell silent. The audience burst into applause. Once the Congressional Black Caucus got past its divisive primary split, early wounds began to heal there as well. In 2007, many attendees and lawmakers at the Caucus Foundation's annual gathering spent blocks of time debating whether Obama was black enough. By the time the same conference rolled around in 2008, the title of one major panel was, Does It Matter If You're Black? Indeed, an extensive study conducted in part by Columbia University's Center on African American Politics and Society found that 60% of blacks say class trumps race when it comes to identity. But 44% of the African Americans surveyed said they do not expect racial equality to occur in their lifetimes. This does not sound like a society that truly believes we are prepared to entirely set race aside. The candidate may be judged not black enough or too black, but one way or another, race counts. Chapter 9. Deval Patrick. Don't tell Deval he can't do something, particularly because he's black or because it's not his turn. That, to him, is a real challenge. Diane Patrick. To understand how big a deal it is that Deval Lardine Patrick is occupying the blue-carpeted third-floor corner office under the dome at the Massachusetts State House, you have to go back a couple of decades and a couple of centuries. The walls of the more than 200-year-old Beacon Hill landmark are lined with ornate portraits and marble and bronze busts of dead white men. Hancock, Adams, Winthrop, Lodge, Endicott. Their names grace town squares and government buildings throughout a state where the future arrived on the Mayflower, not on the slave ships that docked some distance south. The governors have all been white, the mayors have all been white, and the overwhelming majority of the state legislature has always been white. Deval Patrick, the black son of Chicago's South Side, is well aware of this as he walks past the paintings and the busts along the cracked Italian mosaic flooring to Nurses' Hall on the second floor, where a ceremony awaits. A clutch of white male lawmakers have gathered to congratulate the victorious Walpole Little League baseball team, all the members of which, it happens, are also white. But quickly, the new order becomes clear as the Red Sox mascot steps aside and the men on the stage acknowledge the arrival of the most important man in the room. The crowd stands from their folding chairs to applaud respectfully. "Save it for them," Patrick says, gesturing toward the Little League players. In the remarks delivered from a folded piece of paper he removes from his jacket pocket, he congratulates the boys for their effort, their grit, and, he says this with a little fist pump, their attitude. It seems that this mod-looking black man knows a thing or two about attitude himself. How else could he have become the first African-American governor of Massachusetts, only the second African-American ever elected to run a state since Reconstruction? When Patrick surprised insiders in and out of the state by winning the top job in 2006, he had just turned 51. No Democrat had held the Bay State's executive job in 16 years— not since Michael S. Dukakis, who gave up the job in 1991 after having run a dismal and losing 1988 presidential campaign. Patrick didn't just win, he pounded his Republican opponent, Kerry Healy, in a landslide, garnering 56% of the vote in a state where African Americans make up just under 7% of the population. Moreover, he defeated Healy after her own attempts to paint him as a weak-kneed sellout lawyer backfired. Central to her campaign were ads that focused on Patrick's 2002 defense of a jailed Puerto Rican felon named Benjamin Laguerre, who was convicted of raping a 59-year-old white woman in her Lemonster apartment. Patrick contributed $5,000 to a defense fund that paid for DNA tests intended to exonerate Laguerre. Instead, they linked him to the crime. "What kind of person continually defends a brutal rapist?" one ad asked. Another featured a frightened-looking white woman walking alone to her car in a shadowy garage as a woman's voice intoned, "Deval Patrick, he should be ashamed, not governor." Healy's campaign even sent protesters dressed in the orange jumpsuits prisoners wear to picket Patrick's suburban home. There were no overt references to race in the advertising, but there did not have to be. Healy's tactics proved controversial and her party unpopular, and her campaign never gained traction, even as Patrick's campaign was taking off, Obama-like. So, 40 years after Edward W. Brooke was elected to the U.S. Senate, Patrick became only the second African-American ever to win statewide office in Massachusetts, Brooke, a loyal Republican who no longer lives in Massachusetts, supported Healey. Democrats, he said, need an opposition. But party loyalty took a back seat once Patrick won. Retired now and living in Florida, Brooke, 88, is still keenly interested in politics, pleased that there is a black man in the Massachusetts governor's office, and dismayed until Obama was elected president that there was only one in the Senate. "I take great pride in the fact that Patrick was elected," he told me. "I didn't know him. I had never met him. I met him after he was elected, but he ran a good campaign, and he realized that the only way to win is to put together a coalition." On first meeting, Patrick looks like the kind of man who got beat up on so many school playgrounds that he took refuge in books. And that's not so far from true. Instead of being drafted into gangs, he ran from them, his sister Rhonda said. His childhood was the kind of hardship tale most politicians have to embellish in order to seem more authentic. When his father, who played saxophone with jazz greats Thelonious Monk and Sun Ra, left the family when Duvall was four, he and his sister were raised by their mother in a basement apartment on Chicago's tough South Side. At the Mary C. Terrell Elementary School, he entered a school essay contest titled "Why My Father Should Be Father of the Year." Because his dad was long gone, he retitled his essay, "Why My Grandmother Should Be Father of the Year." He won. When Patrick did make good his escape from the South Side, he ran all the way to Milton Academy, a prep school in Massachusetts that, through a program called A Better Chance, was wooing smart black kids with the promise of scholarships and escape. It was a completely alien environment, and he told writer Will Haygood he was scared to death. He showed up with a blue windbreaker in his luggage because he was told he should bring a blue jacket to the prep school. He didn't know they meant for him to bring a blue blazer. One night, on a run for burgers with his housemaster, he was angry, terrified, and rendered helpless when a group of kids in the parking lot began banging on the car windows, chanting, "Nigger, nigger, get out of here!" He was 15 years old. He got out of there. But young Duvall took to Milton, and it took to him. After his first 3 months there, he returned home for a school break and was greeted in the hallway of the apartment where his family now lived with his grandparents. "You talk like a white boy," his sister Rhonda said. "I was devastated," Patrick recalled to me more than 30 years later, but his grandmother removed the sting. "He speaks like an educated boy," she said without missing a beat. Indeed, the Milton education served him well. He applied to 5 colleges, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Georgetown, and Trinity, and was accepted at every one. He chose Harvard, a place his approving grandmother had never even heard of. But 2 Harvard degrees, a civil rights career, and a presidential appointment later, his grandmother was vindicated. Patrick now shrugs off the sting of his sister's words, but not the lesson they taught him. It was the beginning of realizing that I either had to choose a world to live in or learn to live comfortably in both, he said. I had these parents and family members, each of whom wanted me to choose 100% of one world or another. And I think that and other experiences like it have left me with a very strong sense of how many choices there are out there and how many of them are false. By contrast, he mused recently, his daughter Catherine has traveled on 3 continents and shaken the president's hand. "One generation it took for my family to completely transform our circumstances," he told Brown University students after he became governor. "What will define the character of this generation?" He told the story of what he called the one generation transformation at his 2008 State of the Commonwealth address on Beacon Hill, reminding an audience of lawmakers and residents listening in across the Bay State how far he had come to be there. "I can't think of a time when I didn't enjoy reading," he said, "but I don't ever remember actually owning a book. I got my own bed for the first time in my life when I came east on a scholarship to a boarding school in 1970. In that and so many other ways, coming to Massachusetts was like landing on a different planet." After he graduated from Harvard Law School in 1982, Patrick went to work for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a proving ground for generations of young black attorneys. He struck me as somebody who was ambitious, said Julius L. Chambers, who ran the Legal Defense Fund when Patrick was there. I really didn't view him as politically ambitious, but I viewed him as someone who could probably get into just about anything he wanted. One of the lawyers Patrick worked with was Lonnie Guinier, who had known Patrick's wife, Diane, since high school. She recalls collaborating with Patrick on an Alabama voting rights case in 1985, where he and another attorney, Dana Cunningham, went door to door in rural Perry County, attempting to convince local residents to vouch for the activists who had been working on their behalf. Patrick, Guinier said, would approach a woman sweeping her porch, ignore her attempts to ignore him, and eventually end up cajoling her into talking to him. "Ah, now, why are you being so mean to me?" Patrick would say with a smile. "I ain't that mean, am I?" By the time he was done, everyone was sitting in rocking chairs on the porch enjoying the host's lemonade. Patrick and Guinier were also co-counsel when they sued then-Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton over the state's voter registration laws. She remembers that even though they were on opposite sides, Clinton, a consummate politician, admired Patrick's people skills. "He has a future as a politician," the future president told Guinier at a Renaissance weekend retreat in the 1980s. "I never doubted then that he would assume a leadership role and a public role," she says now, "but I can't say I thought of him as a politician." That would happen years later. Elaine Jones, who succeeded Chambers at the Legal Defense Fund, did see the politician in him. She told me she was only surprised that Chicago native Patrick chose his adopted state of Massachusetts in which to make his political stand. Patrick, like Obama and other breakthrough leaders, did not seem to buy the notion that politics was the preserve only of those who had spent decades climbing the insider's rungs. "One thing these guys have in common, and they need it, is some boldness," she said. "They have to be willing to step out there and think differently and believe that they can meet any challenge." The future governor joined Hill & Barlow, a well-known Boston firm, in 1986, and became one of exactly two black lawyers there. The other was Reginald Lindsay. The two outsiders, the younger one from Chicago, the older one from Birmingham, Alabama, bonded instantly. Being an outsider meant coping with casual insults, something both men got. Lindsay, now a federal judge in Boston, remembers arriving at Harvard Law School from historically black Morehouse College and being asked by a white student if he thought he belonged there. By the time Patrick arrived 10 years later, no one was asking those questions anymore. "I think there's been acceleration in the country about race relations and about ambition, the ambition of African Americans," Lindsay told me. "There are things I wouldn't have thought of that people like Duvall and Barack think of. The things that I wouldn't have thought possible, they think are not only possible, but likely." Patrick's first brush with national politics came when President Bill Clinton nominated him to be Assistant Attorney General in 1994 and take charge of the 250 Attorneys Civil Rights Division. Patrick would be Clinton's second choice. His first choice, awkwardly, had been Patrick's old friend and Legal Defense Fund colleague, Guinier, now a University of Pennsylvania professor whose nomination had just collapsed under the weight of a bitter uproar over some of her writings. The nomination was rife with meaning, and Duvall called Guinier before he accepted Clinton's offer to make sure she would not mind. "It's not that he asked permission," she said, "but he said, 'Lonnie, I won't do this if you object.'" Patrick took the oath of office in April 1994. "To be a civil rights lawyer, you must understand what the law means," he said after he took the oath of office. "But to understand civil rights, you must understand how it feels to be trapped in someone else's stereotype." While he was working for Clinton, it fell to Patrick to implement the president's plan to mend, not end, affirmative action, and to police discrimination in mortgage lending. He also won a $45 million racial discrimination judgment against the Denny's restaurant chain. Conservative critics said he was a liberal ideologue, but he had the support of the one who mattered, the president. When he left Washington in 1996, Patrick headed back to Boston, where his wife and two daughters had remained, and back into private practice at one of New England's largest law firms, Day, Berry & Howard. 1 year later, when he was 40 years old, Texaco recruited Patrick to become general counsel after the company settled a $176 million racial discrimination suit when executives were caught on tape making demeaning remarks about minority employees. His job? To lead a task force overseeing the settlement. Another general counsel stint followed, this time at the Coca-Cola Company, where he was once again the company's highest-ranking black executive. By the time he landed a $360,000-a-year board position at the parent company of AmeriQuest Mortgage, Patrick was comfortably wealthy. Those who knew Patrick during this time recognized the ambition in the man, but not the political fire in the belly he would display only a few years later in the tough Massachusetts race. "I sure was surprised," Reginald Lindsay told me. "I wondered after Duvall had finished hobnobbing with Texaco and with Coca-Cola, what would be of interest next? And so Governor seemed right. After you've been out to Paris, you're not going to go back to the farm." Diane Patrick, who married the future governor in 1984 and is now a partner at the Boston law firm of Ropes & Gray, always knew her husband was drawn to public service, but found it stunning when he decided to run for Massachusetts governor. "That was, in anybody's estimation," she told me, "a real shocker, an uphill ride in Massachusetts given our demographics, given our history, given that we have an entrenched political establishment. And he'd never held office in the state, so it was a real, real, real long shot." Patrick made his rounds, telling others about his ambition. One of the first people he consulted was another politically ambitious Harvard Law graduate who, in an earlier meeting at a downtown Chicago coffee shop, had asked for Patrick's support as he ran for U.S. Senate. Now it was time to return the favor. He says, "I want to run for governor," Barack Obama recalled. "I said, let's go." Christopher Edley Jr., the dean of the University of California at Berkeley's law school, has crossed paths with breakthrough politicians his entire career, which included working for the Carter and Clinton administrations, involvement in the 1988 Dukakis campaign, and teaching law at Harvard. It was at Harvard that he met both Patrick and Obama, 10 years apart. Asked to compare the two, he declined. "There's no winning that," he said. "Both showed promise early on," said Edley, who famously supported Obama, even though his wife, fellow Clinton administration alum Maria Echaveste, was a fierce supporter of Hillary Clinton. Duvall was amazing. He and Barack both. In that sense, they had a certain kind of presence. This sounds corny, but they glowed. In Massachusetts, Patrick's decision to return and seek the top job without as much as a dog catcher's election under his belt arrived like a bolt out of the blue. "I've been around here a long time," said Wayne Budd, a black Republican lawyer who served as a U.S. attorney and associate attorney general in the first Bush administration. "I was as surprised as anybody." "I wasn't surprised that he ran or wanted to run," his friend Reginald Lindsay said. "What surprised me about it was the notion he could win. He came, as far as the political scene was concerned, from nowhere." Patrick's appearance on the Massachusetts political scene, a tight-knit and hierarchical system that does not welcome outsiders, was not, to put it mildly, universally embraced. Democrat Thomas Riley, the attorney general, had been anointed as next in line. People said, "I think you're a fabulous person, and you'd be a great candidate, probably better than the other candidate, but it's not your turn," Patrick says now, secure in the knowledge that he proved them all wrong. "I heard that a lot." He shrugged off their warnings and the notion of waiting his turn without a backward thought. "I just don't think it counts for much in a democracy," he said. Riley, a well-connected Irish Catholic politician from Western Massachusetts, happened to be Springfield native Wayne Budd's best friend. Budd was the most practical of black Republicans. He joined the party because he, Riley, and a third friend were attempting to create a nonpartisan law firm. Ideology was secondary in a state that had, after all, managed to send a black Republican to the U.S. Senate. Aware of the history-making potential of a black candidacy, but loyal to his childhood friend, Budd was one of those who told Patrick to wait and perhaps try for a lieutenant governor instead. He had been out of the state a long time, and growing up here, you always think homegrown people are the only people that really have a shot at running for office, Budd said. I just didn't think he had a chance. Bud was obviously very wrong. Patrick rolled over Riley by 50% to 23% in the September primary. Just 6 months before, polls had shown Riley leading Patrick by double digits, including among African-American voters. Riley was widely seen as a good but awkward campaigner, while Patrick glad-handed voters with the true zeal of a natural-born politician. On an emotional level, Duvall was 10 times more attractive than Tom, Bud admitted later. Patrick then set his sights on Republican nominee Kerry Healey, the lieutenant governor, who theoretically should have held at least a name recognition advantage over the newcomer. But Healey's miserably run campaign allowed Patrick to roll up impressive majorities throughout the state, even in neighborhoods such as South Boston, where a mere decades before, residents had rioted at the very notion that black children might be bused into their schools. Months later, Healey reflected that time had simply run out for Republicans in Massachusetts, and Patrick benefited from that. People considered this an unusual race and a positive race, Healey told me, in that whoever was elected, there would be a glass ceiling broken, whether it had to do with gender or race. The perception that Healey had run a racist campaign may also have helped Patrick in the black community, where he was largely unknown. There is nothing like a perceived attack from an outsider to make otherwise warring insiders band together. I think that as criticisms leveled against women are often interpreted through the lens of gender, any criticisms leveled at a candidate of color may be seen through that lens as well, Healey told me. It's very hard to discern that when you're in the middle of the fray. Add to that fray one more complication. More than a few black leaders were suspicious of this new guy on the block and did not readily welcome him into their club. Especially suspect among black clergy in particular was his support of gay marriage and abortion rights. Patrick was halfway through his first term before some of the reason for his energetic support of gay rights became clear. His adult daughter, Catherine, in an interview with a Boston gay newspaper, announced she was a lesbian. The governor and his wife joined her to march in Boston's annual Gay Pride Parade later that week. Patrick decided he could not change the minister's minds on such a fundamental difference of opinion. He could only plead with them to agree to disagree. In politics, we need to get past the point where the view is, unless we agree on everything, we can't work together on anything, Patrick told a black church congregation in Springfield. Maneuvering his way through intra-racial minefields, he recruited early support from old friends such as Diane Wilkerson, until recently the lone black female in the Massachusetts State Senate. It did not hurt that, as a well-known firebrand lawmaker from a majority black Boston district, Wilkerson was able to lend Patrick the race credibility he somehow lacked on his own. I found myself during the gubernatorial campaign doing a lot of what I call whispering, winking, and nodding, hand-holding, she says. Just asking our folk, just bear with us. My line was that it's not so important that the brother be wearing a dashiki as it should be that you know he knows what a dashiki is. Credibility, it should be noted, can cut both ways. In spite of Patrick's support, Wilkerson was defeated in her 2008 re-election primary race. Worse, shortly before the general election, for which she attempted a write-in comeback, she was arrested and later indicted on 8 counts of extortion for allegedly accepting $23,500 in bribes. She resigned her seat just before Thanksgiving. Wayne Budd, for one, believes it actually helped that Patrick was a black man, but not the sort of black man who might scare anyone. Maybe it's a part of the old Ed Brook genre, Budd said. He was very fresh, very alive, very articulate, very charismatic, and people saw him not as a black candidate. They clearly did not. As countless new black leaders have discovered, the key to breaking through often lies in just such a crossover, putting whites at ease without alienating blacks. Patrick stoked that racially transcendent notion throughout his campaign. I do need to be not just the first black governor, he would say, but the best governor you've ever had. On election night 2006, 6,000 jubilant Patrick supporters flocked to Heinz Veterans Memorial Convention Center to celebrate. More Democrats voted in the 2006 primary, 915,209, than in any other since 1990, with Patrick's grassroots organizing effort boosting turnout by nearly 20%. You are every Black man, woman, and child in Massachusetts and America, and every other striver of every other race and kind who is reminded tonight that the American dream is for you, too, he exulted. If history is any guide, there is every reason to believe Patrick was not going to succeed in this America. His childhood fit the stereotype of countless young Black men whose futures are derailed. But his mother and grandparents had plans for young Deval. When he was 6 or 7, his mother took him to hear Martin Luther King Jr. speak in a park on Chicago's South Side. I never met Dr. King. I don't remember a single word he said that day, Patrick says now. I remember what it felt like. I remember the sense of common cause with people in that park. People like me. Nothing but hope. Years later, even Kerry Healy gave Patrick credit for pulling off what had seemed politically impossible. He was able to overcome the good old boy system, she said, the very traditional, almost Tammany Hall-style politics that has dominated the state for a number of years. Deval was able to build a successful grassroots candidacy and overcome all of those structural disadvantages in ways that were quite extraordinary for the Democratic Party. On the day he was sworn in as governor, he took his oath on the Mendi Bible, an artifact freed slaves presented to former President John Quincy Adams. On his office wall, he hung a portrait of former Governor John Albion Andrew, who urged Abraham Lincoln to create the first Black Civil War regiment. Like many change agents, Patrick brought a full head of steam into his first months in office, but not a lot of knowledge about how best to make that change actually happen. Shortly after the election, Patrick presented Doug Rubin, the campaign strategist who later became chief of staff, with his wish list of state projects. Rubin recalls, "I went back to him like an hour later and I said, 'This is a great list for your first 4 years.' He said, 'No, this is my first 6-month list.'" Then, during his first 100 days in office, the new governor hit a wall. His supporters charitably called them rookie mistakes. His critics called them the boneheaded missteps of an arrogant neophyte. His supporters say they were shocked to arrive at the State House and find that the Republicans had not left anything behind to work with, not even furnishings for the governor's office. "We were ready to roll," which meant that everyone, the 65 people we had hired for the governor's team, was in place, in their offices, ready to go to work, said Joan Wallace Benjamin, Patrick's first chief of staff. "Very few people walk into a company, even when a company has been bought, and there is nothing there for the new owner, and you just kind of start brand new making new paper from the first day. And that, to me, was very surprising, even scary." Right away, Patrick started making unforced errors. He decided to replace the chief executive's old Ford Crown Victoria with a new Cadillac DeVille DTS, which cost over $20,000 more than a new Ford would have. He couldn't have sent a worse, more racially loaded signal if he'd started breakdancing at his inaugural ball. Talk radio hosts, tabloids, and bloggers jumped all over him. He was dubbed Coop DeVal. He was accused of pimping his ride. Even his political opponents were taken aback at the racially tinged vitriol. Diane Patrick said it was frankly racist that Boston media could denounce her husband's so-called tricked-out car when it was identical to the model other governors used. "It didn't have speakers on the outside, but they called it tricked out," she told me, the astonishment still in her voice. Another double standard, no doubt. But Patrick could have learned a thing or two from the flamboyant former San Francisco mayor, Willie Brown, who wore custom-made suits and drove a Porsche Turbo while he was Speaker of the California House. He settled for a Lincoln Town Car from the city fleet when he became mayor, though, because if he got the caddy he wanted, he wrote later, he knew he would give my enemies an opening to attack me as a princeling. Then Patrick shelled out nearly $30,000 of taxpayers' money to outfit his new office, $12,000 of it just for pricey, custom-designed damask drapes for the historic 20-foot-tall windows overlooking Boston Common. Never mind that the previous governor, the millionaire Mitt Romney, had bought all his own furniture and took it with him when he left, including the drapery. You can't go to Linens and Things and buy curtains for these windows. They have to be cut to fit, Wallace Benjamin said. It was so ridiculous it would have been funny if it had not been us living it. Yet, while they were racing along at breakneck speed, Patrick and his new staff failed to grasp one of the fundamentals of politics. Appearance often trumps reality. In what was to become a familiar Patrick feint, the new governor at first defended the expense, then derided the critics who wouldn't let it go. Then belatedly, he apologized, offering to swallow the nearly $30,000 it had cost to refurbish his office, as well as a portion of the cost of the Cadillac's lease. He's learning how important symbolism is, the state minority leader said. The governor's political naivete came back to haunt him within a month when he decided to call up an old pal to vouch for a controversial mortgage lender now seeking backing from a top bank. The pal was Robert Rubin, who had been Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary when Patrick was at the Department of Justice. Now Rubin was a top official at Citigroup. Patrick had only recently served on the board of AmeriQuest, the home lending firm, which was now struggling under the weight of accusations that the company was involved in predatory lending. The company needed cash, and Citigroup had it. Less than a week later, AmeriQuest and Citigroup struck a deal, and Patrick's call began to look mighty suspicious, especially since the big New York bank did business in and was regulated by the state of Massachusetts. Once again, Patrick insisted he'd done nothing wrong since he no longer served on the AmeriQuest board. But he was the governor now, and the insider's intercession stank to high heaven. No wrongdoing was found, but Patrick learned the hard way, as he often seemed to, that good intentions can be trumped by bad appearances. This was a politically costly lesson for someone who had won office in part because he seemed so squeaky clean. He called them stupid mistakes. Few of his critics were even that charitable, and the whole affair left an unnecessary early stain on his new administration. Wallace Benjamin herself, who headed the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts for 11 years, was one of the problems. New to government and its insider ways, she had earned her stripes as an executive in the nonprofit world, also running a well-regarded children's charity called the Home for Little Wanderers. None of that could have prepared her for the upheaval of hardball politics. She was among the first to go. There was a steep learning curve, the Wellesley graduate said after she left government. But I've had learning curves before in my life. I can learn anything I want to learn. It wasn't that I couldn't learn. It was, did I want to learn it? Part of the problem was staff, but a lot of it was the self-confident governor himself. He genuinely has a tin ear, said Stephen Crosby, dean of the McCormick Graduate School of Policy Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Patrick's first year was uniquely of his own making, he said. He didn't have a network. No one had ever heard of him. The political class in Massachusetts had never heard of him. Doug Rubin, the next chief of staff, says the early problems were magnified by confounded insiders who had spent decades climbing the rungs of Massachusetts politics. You could never paint him as one of the guys, he says. He wasn't part of the establishment. He was new. He was different. But he wasn't, I guess, what the stereotypical African-American candidates were. I think early on, people didn't have a box to put him in. Patrick was trying to construct an entirely new box, one in which transcendence was a concept that went beyond race. I believe the challenges before us transcend party-partisan politics, he said when he endorsed Obama in October 2007. We don't just need a Democrat, we need a leader. People want to find ways to each other, he said later, sitting with me in his massive office one fall afternoon after the Little Leaguers left. They don't want to be told that there aren't differences, that the paradigm is color blindness. People, they understand their differences, and some of them are sharp. When Patrick talks like this, he sounds as if he has been studying from a shared Obama playbook. When Patrick ran for governor, he adopted the slogan, Together We Can, a variation of the resonant union chant, Yes We Can, Si Se Puede, The political language they used was so similar, in fact, that it briefly caused a stir in the presidential campaign. Was Obama stealing Patrick's lines or vice versa? Hillary Clinton even accused Obama, who campaigned on a platform of change you can believe in, of plagiarism. Change you can Xerox, she said in one debate. The Texas audience booed. The truth was, neither had to steal from the other because their thinking was so much alike. They even shared political consultants. While campaigning in Iowa for Obama, Patrick told reporters he and Obama share a signal characteristic. Each serves as a bridge between different worlds. It would not be the only strategy shared by the two friends. Patrick, Obama joked, stole a whole bunch of lines from me. Payback came in the form of Patrick's 45,000-strong list of political supporters, each of whom was peppered with pro-Obama emails. The political commentators and self-appointed experts start telling us that we can't have what we want, Patrick wrote in a Boston Globe opinion piece during the final days of the presidential primary campaign in neighboring New Hampshire. I heard that throughout my own campaign. I don't care if it's not his turn because I know in my head and in my heart that it is his time. Obama lost a primary in Massachusetts, but when he won the nomination, he appointed Patrick one of 14 national co-chairs of the campaign's 50-state voter registration drive. All this, coupled with Patrick's energetic weekend campaigning on Obama's behalf throughout the 2008 campaign, naturally led to speculation that Patrick would follow Obama to Washington. Goodness no, Patrick responded, this is the greatest job going. But Obama's Bay State primary defeat exposed some problems for Patrick back home. Among Democrats, Patrick was no political match for the pro-Clinton party veterans arrayed against him, Boston Mayor Thomas Menino and House Speaker Sal DeMasi. DeMasi in particular took pains to compare Obama with Patrick, and not in a flattering way. I really don't want my president to be there in a learning process for the first 6 months to a year. National conservatives gearing up to run against Obama liked that line of reasoning and seized the opportunity to recast a storyline about the two breakthrough politicians into one about the perils of naivete and inexperience. If Deval Patrick is indeed a preview of Barack Obama, the conservative magazine Weekly Standard wrote, the lesson is buyer beware.
Context of white supremacy. I had my internet signal. My internet signal dropped. So just taking a moment to get my signal back and then we'll be ready to roll. When I lost my internet signal, it disconnected me from the folks that are listening online, so I'm just going to take a second to reconnect them, and then we'll be ready to roll. Again, context of white supremacy. This is our book study session on Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. This is the end of the first study segment, and as soon as I get us reconnected, I'll get our callers and see if folks have any commentary they would like to share on the first segment. Okay, here we go. So give me 5 seconds if anybody got disconnected who is listening online. You should be able to just reload the page if you're listening online or at TuneIn or Black Talk Radio Network. Okay, should be all back. You should be able to hear the live stream if you were listening at Black Talk Radio Network or if you were listening at TuneIn. It should be reconnected. Just refresh the page and it'll be all good. Just my internet signal went out at the beginning of the program, right when we were ready to go live. That caused a few seconds delay, and then I lost my signal right when the audio was about to conclude. But should be corrected, all good, ready to roll. The number to dial, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. You can use the free VOPE line if you don't want to use your phone to chime in. The free VOPE line, it's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyTiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. tinyTiny.cc/1race. Again, the number one. Once you put that in, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Once you click that, it will open a tiny window on your screen. The first line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. Same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. Then press the number 1. I will see your hand on the switchboard and we can get you on the line. Next week will be our last session on this book. I thought it would be 6, and that's what it'll be exactly. So people can already be kind of thinking of final thoughts, what they will take away from the text. Miss Gwen Eiffel, I know a lot of folks have said, and including myself, that this has not been their most favorite book, but hopefully we got some constructive information about racism, white supremacy as we read. Folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, Thomas in New York and Roz, both of you are with us. As I see other hands, I will nab those lines as well. Feel free to share your comments, folks.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Hello? Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
I hear you.
Oh, okay, okay. For some reason, I thought the call might have dropped. I didn't hear anything. Greetings to you, Gus, to all the callers and the listeners, and also to Thomas in New York. I'm glad you were able to call in today. I missed the last, like 2 sessions, and I have to catch up on them. It's been a little crazy recently, but I also wasn't able to find my place in the very beginning, so I actually had to start at the beginning of I think it's chapter 9, because I didn't realize. I thought when you were the place you were at, I thought you were already in chapter 9, so I spent most of the chapter 8 portion of the reading looking for my spot until you got to chapter 9. That's when I realized that you were actually in chapter 8. But just to start off, I don't even know what page this is, because thanks again, Gus, for sending me the Kindle version of the book. It says, I guess this, it says 21 minutes left in the chapter, but it starts off a paragraph about Mr. Deval Patrick. It says, a childhood was the kind of hardship that most politicians have to embellish in order to seem more authentic. When his father, who played saxophone with jazz greats Thelonious Monk and Sun Ra, left the family when Deval was 4, he and his sister were raised by their mother in a basement apartment on Chicago's tough South Side. At Mary C. Terrell Elementary School, he entered a school essay contest entitled, Why My Father Should Be the Father of the Year. Because his dad was long gone, he retitled the essay, Why My Grandmother Should Be the Father of the Year, and he won. I found that very interesting simply because white people love to relish in black suffering and the things that we have to go through in the system of white supremacy just to try to survive on a basic level. So I just found it interesting that they actually said a lot of other politicians have to embellish their history, whereas his was pretty hardcore just based on the fact that his father left and he was raised by his mother in such a impoverished kind of a scenario. And it just kind of also made me think of someone that I used to work with.
Thank you. Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
Oath of office in April 1994, to be a civil rights lawyer, you have to understand what the law means. He said after he took the oath of office, but to understand civil rights, you must understand how it feels to be trapped in someone else's stereotype. And I found that interesting because I just hate the term civil rights. I wish to be more accurate, he would have said human rights, because really this struggle, like Minister Malcolm said, is a human rights struggle. And the stereotypes that he's speaking of, living in someone else's stereotype, is racism, white supremacy. So to me, that just shows, and of course he isn't a victim as well, so VGQ, but it just shows how some of us really just don't have an accurate depiction of what's happening to us, and we mislabel some of these situations as civil rights when there's nothing civil about America and how it began. And to me, there's really no such thing as civil rights. It's just human rights, and that's pretty much what our struggle has been all about. So just striving for accuracy, I found that to be interesting. Skip a paragraph down. They wrote, when he left Washington in 1996, Patrick headed to Boston, where his wife and two daughters remained, and back into private practice at one of New England's largest law firms, Day, Berry, and Howard. 1 year later, when he was 40 years old, Texaco recruited Patrick to become general counsel after the company settled a $176 million racial discrimination suit when executives were caught on tape making demeaning remarks about minority employees. His job? To lead a task force overseeing the settlement. And this just reminds me of what white people do. They practice racism, white supremacy. They get caught practicing racism, white supremacy, and then they put a black face in front of their practice of racism, white supremacy. So he has to now oversee this the settlement that took place, the same way Obama had to take over such a horrific situation from George Bush and had to basically take responsibility for that, and he's still going to wear the responsibility probably ad infinitum. And, of course, we have the famous New York Mayor David Dinkins. So, again, they always racially showcase black people whenever they do something and they want to obfuscate reality and put a black face on the misery that white supremacy causes. I think this is the last thing. Is a section where she writes, Wayne Budd, for one, believes it actually helped Patrick that Patrick was a black man, but not the sort of black man who might scare anyone. Maybe it's part of the old Ed Brooks genre, Budd said. He was very fresh, alive, and very fresh, very alive, very articulate, very charismatic, and people saw him not as a black candidate. They clearly did not. As countless new black leaders have discovered, the key to breaking through often lies in such a crossover, putting whites to ease without alienating blacks. So this is telling simply because you have a system of white supremacy where our enemies, white people, continue to terrorize us. And even when trying to make any sort of moves within the system, especially in the area of people activity known as politics, that you still have to cater to and buffer the feelings of white people and not and put them at ease in order to make any headway in the system that they dominate and control, and at the same time not alienate more confused black people and other non-white people in the system. So again, even though they're the dominant ones, they're the ones who brutalize us on a daily basis, we still have to function as we did on the proverbial plantation by not making the people who are in power angry in order for us to make any headway in the system. So those are my observations due to my snafus in the beginning. Thank you so much. I'm loving the reading so far, and I love to hear what Thomas in New York and the other listeners have to say, as well as yourself, guys. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that. Lots of snafus. Lost my connection again briefly, but got it restored. Same procedure if folks got disrupted listening online or tune in, wherever. Thomas in New York, I think retired firefighter, is with us. If other folks have commentary you want to share, feel free. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Ross. Good evening to the retired firefighter, all the rest of the callers and listeners. Have a couple of observations. This was the Doral chapter, I guess, and it was very informative to learn some information about Mr. Doral, who I had very little knowledge of. That was pretty good. It said that his any indication that because his grandmother didn't know what Harvard was, his 2 degrees and his civil rights, the civil rights history vindicated her. And I wanted to know if that was her words or was that someone else's words.
Say it again, please.
You talked about Duval's grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And said she was vindicated for not knowing of Harvard when he got his 2nd degree in his long civil rights career.
Right.
And I just want to know if that was her words or if it was the words of someone else. Quote.
The word vindicated itself, those are her words. Where she's saying basically, I think this is all connected to the portion when he came home and his sister said that he spoke like a white person and his grandmother responded he speaks like an educated person. And so then she gives all of his accomplishments, Harvard, Yale, blah, 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 everything else that he did, getting accepted to all these places and going to all these schools and everything, his civil rights career, that vindicated his grandmother, saying that this is an educated person. And those were Gwen Ifill's words, not a quote or anything.
Oh, okay. I thought it was her not knowing of Harvard. Oh, either way, that was Gwen Ifill's words. Okay. All right. I just thought it was very odd to compare Duval to Obama, kind of in the way of, you know, their accomplishments and achievements. It seemed like Duval was very, very much into the civil rights movement and trying to get people probably vindicated from charges and that might have been racially, you know, given to them what they do. And I don't recall Obama doing anything like that. He was a community organizer. You know, we have no idea of what he really organized. I haven't seen any evidence of him organizing anything in Chicago. So, I just thought it was very odd for her to, I guess at that time, I guess that's what they were doing, making that comparison. But I just don't get that comparison at all. And, you know, it seems like Duval was just way more accomplished in what he was trying to do, regardless of the motives, but at least he was doing something for black people. And I just didn't get that from Obama's career prior to him becoming a politician or prior to him becoming the president at all. I just thought that she just, went through the script, and this chapter in particular, I got a lot of knowledge about Mr. Duval and his growing up and his thought process and some of his accomplishments and achievements, and I thought it was very good. And I'll be on my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The caller formerly known as 1842, Emmy, should be here, as well as retired firefighter. If you all had commentary, feel free.
Ladies first. If she wants to.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Oh, okay. Fabulous. Good evening, everyone. And let's do this. Hopefully this is better. I think this is probably better. This chapter, because we started it last week, is definitely very interesting and informative for me. I have a couple of notes, not necessarily quite specific to, you know, direct text, but just observations from the text. I was thinking about what being a Black politician does to the mental health of these individuals. I think that without having a proper functioning definition of racism, white supremacy, that they are enduring and experiencing extreme trauma and stress and what we're looking at in terms of how their response to it, which is not any different from any of us. But for instance, the part where I think it's Duvall ran far away from Chicago as he could the moment he got there, and he was in a car and there were white people chanting like "nigger leave." And I mean, like those kinds of things, I would have preferred if Ms. Eiffel spent a bit more time delving into those type of things. But you know, c'est la vie, it is what it is. But just to speak more about being a Black politician versus a lot of other, like, for me, meaningless controversies and things like that. I don't know if they realize that they're being showcased because, and let me say this next, that I don't think, and I could be totally incorrect, just a mere postulation, that it's the two don't go together. You can't seek white people's approval and be for Black people when you have a proper understanding of racism, white supremacy. The more you're confused, I guess you may be able to justify that pattern of behavior, but I, based off of what I'm hearing and my observations, I don't think that that's possible. And I think what I'm seeing in the politicians that were vying to become, you know, politicians or enter into certain areas is that they're really always constantly seeking the approval of seeking the approval of white people and kind of just making sure that Black people know that they're quote unquote Black enough. And I think the more that we non-white people, specifically Black people, have to do a lot of things to make white people like us, that it is extremely detrimental to our Black self-respect, our Black mental health, and ultimately at its core, if you have to do things to make people like you, negate your Blackness, essentially, it means that even if they do turn around and like you, it means that they don't respect you. And I don't know if these individuals understand that, or it's possible that they do, and just Ms. Eiffel is not enumerating it in the book, but it would be, I think, a more powerful book, a more relevant book, could have a little bit of a longer shelf life if these things were stated clearly. I mean, for going and walking on the sidewalk and there's a white woman who's doing everything in her power to avoid you, you having to go up and talk to her and do all of the kind of things that you'd have to do to get her to finally sit on her rocking chair on her porch and sip lemonade. I'm not coming at the individuals who are doing this. I think they're doing the best that they can. They're ambitious. You know, they want to be somebody, you know, more so than actually fix a problem. And I understand that completely, but I don't think that that leads to having any kind of self-respect or that would be substantial to causing any change or having that strong mental health. I don't see that at all, which could lead to many mistakes like buying, I think it was a Cadillac. Like, you're not really thinking clearly, I don't think, as if you want to be a so-called Black politician. And then I didn't get a chance to look it up. Gus called on me before I had a chance to Google it. But quid pro quo, that's what it seems like. White people are saying, well, I'll put you here, and then you got me next time, if I'm understanding that term properly. And it's unfortunate because I don't know if you have a proper functioning understanding of racism, you'll understand these things, that white people are not doing anything because they like you or they see your potential as who you are as an individual, more your potential to be useful to their ends, to their means, being a pawn on their chessboard. And so what, like the clip that was played in the beginning of the session today, he was put in office and then he was pretty much told, well, you can't run because this is Hillary's time. And it's like, you know, when you understand racism, then you understand that, like, nothing is done with any, like, you're not a human being. So this isn't mutual. I'm using you to this end. I also think that we read Spook Who Sat by the Door. And I think if Duvall had read that, he would have known, don't get a Cadillac. It's not, you know, the right material, the right information, and can inform us as individuals at this level, but also individuals at higher levels on better things to do. Freeman knew better. You don't buy a flashy car. White people are not going to like you buying a flashy car. I just put the two together. And I wanted to comment, I forget, and it was a little bit towards the end, that I personally don't think that it is enough to know what a dashiki is. That doesn't make me feel validated as a Black person if some Black politician came to me and was like, well, look, I don't wear a dashiki, but at least I know what it is. Isn't that enough? No, for me, it's not enough. I think there are a lot of white people who know what dashikis are. I would say if we're going to use that kind of analogy or metaphor, that it is more important to understand the importance of the dashiki and why the dashiki could and should be viewed as professional attire or attire that can be worn in, you know, outside of just cultural festivals and things like that, and that we should reclaim the dashiki as a legitimate piece of attire. That would be the level of the conversation. I'm very frustrated when, because I'm Black, I'm being thrown crumbs, and I'm supposed to say, well, at least this person knows what a dashiki. That's not enough. And I think, you know, the way that it was even worded, because I think that's Miss Eiffel's words, I kind of didn't really appreciate that. We get to talk about it to be more specific and clear and direct and hold and demand more, not necessarily just from the victims, from ourselves, from other victims, from politicians, whomever. That just, it was, I don't know, I'm not coming at her at all. It rubbed me the wrong way. I thought it was kind of like tacky, but that's my own personal opinion. Thank you.
Right on. Just for the dashiki line, for our listeners, it was, these were not Gwen Ifill's words. These were Deval Patrick's words. And he said specifically, this is the question about are you Black enough or whatever it is. And he says, just asking our folk, just bear with us. My line was that it's not so important that the brother be wearing a dashiki as it should be that you know he knows what a dashiki is. That's all the direct quote from Deval Patrick. So those are not Miss Ifill's words. Retired firefighter, did you have commentary you were going to add in?
Yes. Greetings, everyone. Here I go without any notes. The first thing comes to my mind with Miss Eiffel, that she perhaps is well-versed into what I call professional politics in the Northwestern Hemisphere. And what it is and how it works, and that's primarily what I'm seeing on a consistent basis, with each chapter that I have had the opportunity to listen to, and it's coming from the perspective of where non-white Black people, their involvement into that process, unfortunately. The book so far has not expanded to the global system of racism and white supremacy and how what she talks about fits into that context. That's where I see there is a problem. I'm not necessarily blaming Ms. Eiffel. I put the blame where it belongs with the white people who make the choice to practice racism and white supremacy. Going further, it's all embedded into this concept, meaning something that is not a reality, is on paper, and a lot of people know how to verse it, this thing that's called America. And I have witnessed this all of my life of you know, well, when I became conscious that I was living, as far as that concerned. That of you know, quote unquote Black achievement. If you work hard enough and you are quote unquote ambitious, you can achieve these certain things. And this is what I'm hearing hearing over and over and over in the readings. And in turn, maybe some of the non-white Black people are aware that they're being showcased. Maybe some of them aren't. But I grew up in an environment where that was basically preached. I can recall the program where I think you had someone that wrote a book about neighborhoods in the quote unquote Black neighborhoods in and around the area where I grew up at. Matter of fact, they talked about Richmond Heights And so that background I'm hearing from Ms. Eiffel, I'm very much aware of you know, if personal achievement is very important, and if this is taking place by us, then this would cause an end to racism. You know, and it's primarily something that's coached from white people, because they have all of the goodies in the world. Actually, they have all of the goodies and everything. And if they train us in that and narrow our minds in that level of understanding, they could just play this. I don't want to say game. It's worse than that. They can just keep with this terror forever, as far as that concerned, because they can pick and choose on who is successful in their plan and who fails. You can be both. You can be successful, and then they can make you fail. You know, so you can go on forever until unless we the victims expand our understanding of what actually is going on in this world, as opposed to a particular part of the world where I'm physically at, and I know it can be done because I've listened to others who has similar thoughts, and I'm, matter of fact, I'm listening to it right now, for most of my life, I've been hearing others who had much more broader understanding of things. Although I don't have any criticism with another non-white black person. That's I'm not qualified. I'm not qualified to do that. But I place it right at the feet of the people who I know are aware of what they're saying and what they're doing in their manipulative skills. Primarily, you know, juggling confused non-white people, you know, is a crime. This is actually what I'm getting out of the book itself, as far as that concern. That's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
We had two other, appreciate him, from retired firefighter. That was a world more concrete about the white supremacy in the history of Miami. The other two folks, Mr. Demery 4 and the caller at 4683. Did you all have commentary you were going to get in?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to other callers. I've been following the book along. My book got in late, so I'm somewhat behind, but I've been listening in. This particular reading, I'd like to comment on the way this system is set up. These so-called breakthroughs, which you could probably refer to them as firsters or whatever you want to say, first in their particular classification to hold these positions. They come with a price. President Obama found out when he was running his campaign, when the videotape came out of his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. They just took a clip of it where he was saying that, calling the USA the U.S. of KKK. But they didn't show the whole sermon. So they would take little sound bites, you know, and show you in a negative light. Whereas on YouTube, it appeared that, you know, he was blaming 9/11 and calling on God to visit damnation on the land of the home and free, according to the author. Now, President Obama had known this man for over 20 years. He married him, he baptized his kids, he blessed his house for 20 years. And then he was forced to denounce his own pastor in what is termed here as a race speech, where he said that Reverend Wright had a negative worldview and that racial differences need not mean racial division, which, you know, there's quite a bit of watering down of the present situation of non-white people, especially black people in the United States. And then when these so-called breakthrough people are, it looks to me that they're singled out and maybe given a scholarship to some prestigious university, and then by some mysterious means, they're bolted to the top, you know, of their particular fields, and then used in a way that the system would be enhanced, or that their particular agenda would be gained. I thought it was interesting that Donna Brazile, they painted her as, you know, the political activist, and she was on stage with these four white men. And she said that, you know, it seems funny that, you know, they would question, you know, President Obama, whether he was black enough or whatever. And she said that he was biracial, had spent 9 months in the womb of a white woman and raised for 19, 21 years by his white grandparents. And yet, when he got out of school and went to Harvard, and all of a sudden he's uppity and something is wrong with him. You know, she may have been able to voice her opinion, but like you say, this book doesn't age very well because they just recently tarnished Donna Brazile, and I think she's basically, I don't know where she is as far as politics, but they smeared her also. And the book is just full of examples of white terrorism, you know, in a watered down way. When they were explaining Deval Patrick and how the walls of the 200-year-old Beacon Hill landmark was lined with portraits and busts of dead white men, and how he was making such a breakthrough, being the mayors, all the governors, everybody had been white. But you know what? When these guys, when you do have a so-called breakthrough, how long does that last? 4 years, maybe 8 years? Then everything goes back to the way that it was. So what good is it to have a so-called symbol of a breakthrough when you have no real change taking place? Like I say, it's full of examples. When Patrick, you know, went to college and he was going on a burger run and in the parking lot, and I presume all these white kids banging on his window calling him nigger. And, well, he was 15 years old, and maybe he was at a prep school. But, you know, these racist attempts and acts that were perpetrated on him were all watered down. That could have been a life-threatening situation right there. There's nothing to take lightly. And then when his sister probably noticed, you know, a change in his demeanor, or it doesn't sound like he had a full grasp of what it's like to be white in America. So he looks like he was, you know, his mannerism, maybe his speech had changed, and his sister said that he sounded like a white person. You know, another point, Lonnie Guarner is a friend of his wife's. You know, I saw a picture of her. She's very light skinned, looks like she had freckles on her face. And Duvall's wife, Patrick's wife, is also very pale, almost in some pictures, look like she may pass for a white person, but I think she's black. But anyway, just talking about these people, and he knew her. And then what I really found suspicious was President Clinton meeting him in the 80s and saying that he had a future in politics. And then 14 years later, then nominating him to be the assistant attorney general. You know, I just don't think these things happen by coincidence. And when Texaco used him, you know, as their general counsel, selling a racial discrimination suit, all this is by design, I think. And one of the reasons why I didn't comment as much as I did, this is almost like a practice in, you know, anti-blackness, because we could just go on and on talking about the black people, what happened, and they're only responding to things that are happening to them. So they are victims also. And then if we were in any of these positions, how would we handle it? So I'll mute my line. One last thing. Mr. Patrick had two daughters, but they didn't mention but one. And they mentioned that one because she had came out to a newspaper and admitted that she was lesbian. So they were able to use that, you know, to solidify his position on gay rights. And it seems like that as non-white black people, we can't get away from these stereotypes. And the Cadillac fiasco, you know, it's just all the same old song. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery 4. And the caller at 4683, did you have commentary?
No, sir. I'm just listening. I just got in late.
All right.
I'm going to mute my line. Thank you.
Yes, sir. A couple quick comments I will get in before we get to the next audio segment. Again, we'll be finishing this book up next week, so if you have final thoughts that you want to share, go ahead and be thinking of those, because next Friday, all done. Let's see, starting off where she's talking about Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Infamous moment has been rehashed regularly for the last decade, where she says, Obama distanced himself from the pastor without alienating black churchgoers, and he used the address to cast himself as the biracial bridge spanning the nation's racial stalemate. I will stop there because these are, except for racial stalemate, now that's a quote, I presume, from President, or at the time it was Senator Obama's speech responding to the whole Reverend Wright kerfuffle. I think that's March of 2008 during the primaries. But that just, wow, the significance of this sentence for many reasons. Number one, metaphors again. Biracial bridge, and I have actually heard that metaphor employed before, and that specifically, that it's biracial people that are the bridge to solve this quote-unquote racial stalemate. And again, it's just on both fronts. Number one, it goes back to that same old trope that somehow if white people and non-white people, if we can just get in bed and get our genitals together, this will solve the problem. And some way, somehow, if you just keep having sex, the offspring, they'll look a little different, and that'll solve the whole problem, which is clear foolishness. And I mean, when I say I've heard this before, I have had a non-white person who had a white parent and a non-white parent tell me that in my face. He thought that was his goal, to be the bridge to unify white people and non-white people. In my view, that's just further evidence of massive confusion. And again, it posits this notion as though this is some sort of equal just dispute or conflict between two equals when nothing could be further from the truth. This is white terrorism. This is not a conflict between equals at all. Next, where she says, Obama told many Americans what they wanted to hear. I think a lot of folks have said, let's be accurate, Obama told whites what they wanted to hear. And this comes up a lot of times in the book, when I think the same sentiment where people have talked about it seems like this, and I've said this too over the weeks, this book seems to focus a lot on black people in conflict with other black people, President Obama calling Reverend Wright's comments stupid, and Jesse Jackson saying he was going to cut President Obama's nuts off, and just black, even Deval Patrick this week, his sister saying that he talked like a white person. Like, this ends up taking up the bulk of the book. And it greatly minimizes that this, you know, is not even close in terms of measuring to the terrorism that white people train and focus on black people all the time. In fact, I can, as I was reading this book, I made a point of checking the references. I have the Kindle edition, so it makes it very easy. You can just click on the citation, and it'll take you to the reference section of the book, and so you can see exactly where she's getting the information from, and sometimes it'll even be linked if it's something online, so you can go right to it. So I was checking a lot of the references. When she talked about, this is for Deval Patrick, when she talked about the moment when he was 15, he was at the school, and he got called a nigger, I think it was Emmy who made that point in terms of where the focus is. We get this emphasis on Deval Patrick's sister saying he sounds like a white person. We leave out a lot of great information, and you can check this online. The Washington Post has this article. It's Deval Patrick and the Great Moral Imperative. This is at the Washington Post, and this is where she quotes some of that incident about what happened when they went to the McDonald's. I'm just going to read what it says. This is from the Washington Post. It says, Patrick eventually was awarded a scholarship from a Better Chance program to attend Milton Academy, an elite Massachusetts preparatory school. One night, he and a housemaster went on a burger run to a local McDonald's. I remember this incredible scene where the kids in the parking lot started banging on the window and shouting and chanting, "Nigger, nigger, get out of here," Patrick said. The housemaster was nervous and was trying to hustle us out of there. We got in the car, and of course, he didn't know what to say. Even the term housemaster. Continuing, now she didn't include any of this. Continuing, Patrick, then 15, felt a rush of emotion. I mean, it's a lot that you feel. Angry, you feel terrified, you feel helpless, he said. The worst that happened was that someone, a couple people, threw their cigarette butts at me. Nobody actually hit me, but you still feel wounded, and if you're not real careful, you can feel ashamed too. You feel ashamed of who you are and what you are, which is a disaster. I find it disgraceful that that got left out of the book. That's what I mean. Like, if a white person had wrote this, my commentary would be a lot more scathing. Like, I have really minimized how much I'm not enjoying this book. I'm glad it will be over next week. I think some people expressed the opinion they thought this book was written for black people. I don't think so. I think this book was written for white people to omit something like that. And I mean, Gwen Ifill, award-winning journalist, you looked at the article. I know you read the whole article. How could you read? And this is the very next paragraph that you quote from where he says that the weight of that sentence, you completely omit it. And I pull that back. The blame, most to blame whites. I've said consistently, white editors, white fingerprints all over this book about whether it's going to be published. This could even be a ghost written project where they just put Gwen Ifill's name and face on it, but some white person cooked this up. Anyway, check out that article in the Washington Post. Also, let's see, other quick things I want to make sure I get in. Guilt factor. This is where she's quoting from a New York Times article that's talking about his speech in reference to Jeremiah Wright, where it says guilt. The guilt factor may be lowered a bit because Obama made it right to be white. I have no. Oh, let me get the whole thing. Obama made it right to be white, whatever that means, and still love your black relatives, and to be black and still love your white relatives. This to me, again, it's there's a lot of conflation. Sometimes she just talks about black people regardless if they have a white parent or not. And then she will come right back around and the same person that she's talking about, they're black. And then they become biracial as well. That is promoting confusion. I have never said non-white people who have a white parent should be mistreated or talked bad about. I've simply said under this system, racists whites, the people in charge of the planet, they deem it significant. If you're a non-white person and you have a white parent, sometimes they even give you a whole different classification. That is fact. Either it's true or it's not. It's clear evidence of that. We should make that clear. And she's even had to say it a few times in the book as well, that whites are more comfortable with these individuals who have a white parent for a variety of reasons. I feel like that hasn't been focused on very much in the text either. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? The portion, this book came out after Katrina, when she talks about Condoleezza Rice and whatever problem she had, people questioning her blackness or what have you. If anything, we could just go to Hurricane Katrina. I think there were a lot of people. There's a really great segment in Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke, where he talks about her the failure of the Bush administration, which she was a part of, to respond to that. That was a moment where a whole lot of people were like, wow, in this position. And this is what she, I think she went to some play in New York. They put her on the spotlight while black people were still dying and in toxic flood water and being shot by white racist vigilantes, where she was chilling at a play in New York. Again, whites would be most to blame. But if we're going to do a thorough book, that might have been something to include. Let's see. I thought this whole narrative, again, I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned Donna Brazile presenting this narrative that whites are more tolerant. Those were the words that were used, not less racist. And that comes up a lot. I think President Obama, not only did he use that same type of terminology, he criticized Reverend Wright, saying that he had a static view of racism as though things have not changed. And that has been like a major theme. He says that all the time. Progress. I play sound clips of that all the time. When he came out to talk about Trayvon Martin, when he came out after the Michael Brown, when they announced that there was going to be no indictment, we've made progress. He says that all the time. We've made so much progress. We've made so much progress. Things are so much better. They used to lynch 100 niggers a year, and now you all just got a Michael Brown every other month. Things are so much better. Whites are so much lit. That is total nonsense, and that's the type of thing, again, whites could be telling him directly to say this. They could be writing that he's going to say it. This might be a requirement for a victim of white supremacy. If you're going to be utilized in a certain way, this is what you got to say. This is how, you know, you show us that you're doing as you are supposed to as our nigra. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I thought it was really important. This is the second time in the book that we've got as a part of a political campaign a black candidate. It was Harold Ford Jr. before in Tennessee, where they ran the ad. He was a pimp going out with some white woman, a call girl, when he went to the Playboy Mansion, and he did lose in that race. And then it happening again with Deval Patrick, saying that he was defending this rapist, and the commercial with some white woman looking terrified, and how are we going to have this nigra for governor, and he's supporting rapists. That, and particularly in the state of Massachusetts, to not bring up Charles Stewart, the white man who killed his pregnant wife and blamed it on a black person, and they went and rampaged whole black areas in Boston, to not bring that up. I just, again, if a white person had wrote this, I would be a lot more picky and scathing in my commentary. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? Not the sort of black man who might scare someone, talking about Deval Patrick again, when you come out and say things either disparaging black people or racism is not, you know, that big of a deal. We've made a lot of progress, that sort of thing. That's what racists want to hear, that, okay, we can trust this nigger to an extent and maybe get some things done with this nigger. Let's see. Last two things I'll get in. Oh, I thought that was so important, particularly if this is Mitt Romney. I need to double check to see if Deval Patrick took over from Mitt Romney as governor in Massachusetts. I'll double check. But she said, or they write, Deval Patrick supporters say they were shocked to arrive at the statehouse and find that Republicans had not left anything behind to work with, not even furnishings for the governor's office. This is all in quotes now. We were ready to roll, which meant that everyone, the 65 people we had hired for the governor's team, was in place in their offices, ready to go to work, said Joan Wallace Benjamin, Patrick's first chief of staff. Very few people walk into a company, even when a company has been bought and there is nothing there from the old owner, and you just kind of start brand new, making new paper from the first day. And that, to me, was very surprising, even scary. She did say it was Mitt Romney that he took over from later in the office, because she said that Mitt Romney bought his own furniture, so he took it all when he left. I don't know if that was a direct act of racism, white supremacy, but I have seen that pattern before. It is mentioned specific, and I mean in great detail, when whites vacated the area of the world known as the Congo in the Central African region, when they left directly being in there in the 1960s, there's documentation they did the exact same thing, down to pulling out phone wires, light bulbs, electrical sockets. You had black people that were just stunned that they were so disgusted and out. How dare these niggers tell us to get out of there? We're taking everything, the napkins, toothpicks, everything, toilet seats. I have seen that same type of racist behavior. I don't know if that's what Mitt Romney did, but it would be interesting to see if that is routine, if that's what typically is done when a governor or an elected official leaves office. Do they just take everything, staplers and all? Last thing I want to get in. The whole Cadillac, yeah, I thought that was great as well. I had other, Lonnie Guinier, that's what I'll get, or two things. I'll get two things in and then I'll call it. Number one, to Mr. Demery Forrest's point about things not being a coincidence, Bill Clinton being quoted this week in the book, in the 80s, saying that he saw, wow, this Deval Patrick, this nigger is something special. He's going to be great in politics. And then in the 90s, when he's in the White House, appointing him, his second choice, appointing him to the assistant to the attorney general. And then that's what I mean. Also, great illustration of having a long range view. Racists do. They're not thinking in terms of the next week, the next year. They generally have like a 50-year outlook on how they're looking at the plantation. So I appoint this nigger in the 90s while I'm in the White House, get him as the assistant attorney general. And then I come back 20 years later. I'm not in office. I'm not running anything. But I come back 20 years later and say, oh, by the way, my wife, I think I want her to be president, so make sure you don't run, and you make sure you tell everyone else to stand down. And remember, I got you that appointment, so you owe me, nigra. That was where we started at, with Les Payne saying that, talking about his displeasure. And you can look online. You can see tons of articles. I also thought it was significant that on this week, Deval Patrick was one of the public vocal critics, saying that President-elect Donald Trump's nomination for the attorney general, Alabama senator, or U.S. senator in Alabama, Jeff Sessions, that he opposed him. Some of what you heard in the book this week, his work going down in Alabama for black people, denied the right to vote. That's what they have been talking about this week, saying that Jeff Sessions lied and saying that he was working with these black people and thought they were so great and all that. And you have to follow it. But Deval Patrick, his name came up. If you click, that's what's going to pop up. His opposition to Jeff Sessions being the attorney general in the Trump administration. And that post that Mr. Patrick got, it was supposed to go to Lonnie Guinier. Now, she didn't get into all this. This is a black female. She didn't get into all this in terms of why, when Bill Clinton nominated her, he had to rescind her nomination. She just said it was because of her writings. If you look online, she was writing about racism. And of course, that's not going to set white people at ease. So they were like, this nigger has got to go. And in fact, they called her a quota queen because she was saying that she supported what they call affirmative action to help compensate victims of racism. And whites flipped out. Again, they called her the quota queen. And there's lots of information online about how people said that that's flagrantly racist, sounding very much like welfare queen and all of its racist implications. I can pause there. We will get to the second audio clip. Folks have additional commentary on audio clip number one. Make a note and we'll make time to include your commentary once we are done. So we're picking up. This is still the chapter on Deval Patrick, chapter 9. More on Deval Patrick to come. Context of white supremacy. This is audio segment number 2.
Breaking through has its costs. John Lewis was hit in the head with a brick at Selma. Vernon Jordan was shot. And families pay a price as well. Martin Luther King Jr.'s wife and children were threatened, and shortly after Patrick moved into the corner office on Beacon Hill, his wife, Diane, dropped out of sight to receive treatment for depression. "I fell out splat in front of the public," she told a Chamber of Commerce luncheon more than a year later. She described the first few months of her husband's term as a roller coaster, and herself as a deeply private person, which hardly fit her new highly public role as the Commonwealth's First Lady. After receiving the treatment, the nature of which she never disclosed, Diane Patrick returned to the public eye, where she says her husband is happiest, but she maintained a low profile. "When we sat down to talk in her high-rise law office with its sweeping view of Boston Harbor, She admitted that the adjustment was a difficult one. "I have to tell you, it took me a long time and a lot of pain to get to where I am now," she said. "I didn't like the scrutiny. I didn't like the criticism. I didn't like the lack of privacy. I didn't like that everything he did, said, where he went was fodder for all the talk radios, all the newspapers, all the magazines, all the columnists. And I felt like they don't know him. How can they say these things about him?" The governor, too, chafed at the claustrophobic nature of the job. Once he told reporters he canceled what was to be a leisurely bike ride when he discovered his security detail was blocking traffic near his vacation home in western Massachusetts. "I put the bike in the truck and said, 'This is not working out,'" he said. That was personal. The public miscues were in many ways more troubling. And along the way, Patrick sometimes allowed his impatience with the new rules of the road to show. "If I walked on water," he complained, "critics would say, 'You know, he can't swim. What's wrong with him?'" None of this stopped Patrick from plunging headfirst into breathtakingly ambitious multi-billion-dollar plans. He drew up a sweeping proposal to provide free education for every Massachusetts resident from the age of 3 through community college. He pushed plans to spend $1 billion on biotechnology, put 1,000 more police officers on the street, reduce property taxes, and dramatically overhaul the state's transportation agencies. Much of this optimistic agenda shrank before the governor's eyes when the economy collapsed in 2008, taking the Bay State's tax revenues with it. In mid-October, he announced he would be forced to cut 1,000 state jobs and order $1 billion in spending rollbacks. Earlier in the year, however, prospects had been considerably brighter. During his annual State of the Commonwealth address, Patrick was able to boast of the creation of 26,000 new jobs. 300,000 adults and children who were uninsured a year ago are insured today and have access to affordable, reliable primary care, he told his State House audience. "The state of our Commonwealth is strong, and the evidence of that strength is tangible. My goodness, even the Red Sox, the Celtics, and the Patriots are on fire." The Patriots, in fact, were undefeated that year, right up until they fell to the underdog New York Giants in a shocking Super Bowl. But the nation's slowing economy was already placing pressure on the new governor to come up with new sources of revenue. Just before the anniversary of his first year in office, he decided to launch a plan to allow 3 resort-style casinos to operate in the state. This measure, Patrick hoped, would allow Massachusetts to hang on to between $900 million and $1.1 billion in gambling cash, otherwise headed over the border to the Indian casinos in Connecticut. The timing, he reasoned, was ideal. As he told a joint legislative committee in December 2007, the state during his time in office had moved from 49th in job creation to 15th. "My late mother used to ask me to take her to Foxwoods," Patrick told the lawmakers, referring to a casino in neighboring Connecticut. "And if she were alive today, my mother would be like the many adults I meet from all across the state who tell me that they have been making their own decisions about what's best for them for a very long while, and they do not need the state to tell them how they should and shouldn't spend their entertainment dollars." Patrick's argument that the plan would create 20,000 jobs and $2 billion in related profits, as well as raise $400 million in taxes to pay for roads and bridges, was supported by the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. And as late as the previous September, 6 months before the vote, a poll showed that 53% of voters supported the casino idea. But the Patrick plan went down to an embarrassing legislative defeat, rejected 108-46, and the governor lost a high-profile battle with the wily and well-connected DeMacy, who should have been a critical ally. The speaker did not immediately reject the casino proposal, but he eventually became its worst enemy, telling the Boston Chamber of Commerce on the day before the House killed the proposal that casinos would, quote, absolutely cause human damage on a grand scale. It ultimately turned out to be a political master's class in how to defeat a neophyte. The fix was in pretty early, Patrick ruefully told reporters after the vote. The blueprint for defeat seemed pretty apparent in retrospect. Patrick disappointed some of his earliest and most liberal backers over the casino proposal. He promised us a new kind of politics, said State Senator Susan Tucker. But casinos represent politics as usual, at its worst. One Boston Globe columnist derided the plan, which would raise money in part for education, as the old slots for tots hustle. And one constituent, in a tartly worded letter to the editor of the Globe, suggested Patrick abandon the search for phantom income from the casinos and stumping for Obama while he was at it. Perhaps Patrick's time on the campaign trail could be better spent meeting with Massachusetts legislators, the editorial read, to convince them his proposals deserve their support. Patrick later patched things up with DeMacy, meeting him on his turf, a restaurant in Boston's Italian North End. Patrick called it a come-to-Jesus encounter. DeMacy said, "We got together and bared our souls." For both men, it was a necessary healing. Another recurring theme that never went away was the appearance that Patrick was simply too ambitious. When he flew to New York and signed a $1.3 million book deal with Broadway Books, on the same day his allies were back at the State House defending his doomed casino plan, even his supporters worried that he was spending more time burnishing his own national reputation than tending to the fires back home. Blue Mask Group, a usually supportive political blog, published a critique titled "Do Deval" that called the book trip a political embarrassment. The less friendly Boston Herald called Patrick an "author-tunist." Immediately after the casino collapse and the brouhaha over the book, a Rasmussen poll showed a whopping 66% of Massachusetts voters ranked the governor's performance as fair or poor. Once again, the conservative magazine Weekly Standard, by now Patrick's most assiduous national media critic, weighed in. It is becoming increasingly evident that Deval Patrick is far more than your garden variety maladroit poll, the magazine wrote. He is instead proving himself a political bungler for the ages. And another conservative news organ, the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal, also piled on, declaring Patrick a pedestrian liberal governor who is remarkably quick to retreat in the face of pressure from the status quo. But Patrick pushed back. John F. Kennedy, he said, had been ambitious, and no one seemed to have a problem with that. Patrick insisted his ambitions, unlike those of governors who preceded him, three or four of whom sought higher office while in office or immediately after their terms, ended at the state line. In Massachusetts, we've had a series of governors who have lost interest in Massachusetts and started to look south, he says. Although Patrick insisted he would not use the Commonwealth as a launching pad, potential challengers watched his ups and downs closely. Charlie Baker, a high-profile Republican who runs Massachusetts' Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, considered seeking the GOP gubernatorial nod in 2006 and has not ruled it out for 2010. Patrick, he notes from the sidelines, set expectations so high that he was bound to encounter resistance from the powerful state legislature. If you go into this with a we-they approach, believing that somehow you can roll them because you're the new kid in town and all the rest, you're going to be in for a big surprise and a big disappointment, said Baker, who spent 8 years on Beacon Hill in Republican William Weld's administration. Because it doesn't work that way. It never works that way. It's not like Patrick could not see some of the setbacks coming. State lawmakers, he admitted in a candid moment, urged him early on to slow down, to let them show him how to do the job. Democrats had free run of the state legislature for 16 years, exercising their balance of power in the best way they knew how, putting the brakes on a succession of governors from the other party. They'd forgotten how to work with someone who was on their side, whatever that means in politics. Then along came Patrick, who was still an outsider. I'm new, I'm brash, I had a big political victory in terms of the numbers against a lot of odds and most expectations, he said, and nothing wears worse than the appearance of being arrogant. And that's not what I meant to project, but I do know I have to be sensitive to that because I don't want to be counterproductive. I just want us to move. But the Democrats in the state legislature put Patrick firmly in his place. He had, after all, leapfrogged over everyone else on Beacon Hill. I certainly know that I cut the line by running for governor, he said. In many ways, Massachusetts is the perfect place for Black history to be made. Crispus Attucks, the first casualty of the American Revolution, was shot and killed on the night of March 5, 1770, during the Boston Massacre. He was Black. But two centuries later, the state, especially its capital, became the site of Black history of a negative sort. In the 1970s, anti-busing riots consumed its schools. In 1988, then-Governor Michael Dukakis saw his presidential aspirations go up in smoke after a Republican campaign ad linked him to a scary-looking Black convict named Willie Horton, who raped a woman while on a weekend furlough granted by Dukakis. With that kind of history, race is never far from the center of the conversation for the state's chief executive, and there are sharp differences of opinion about whether his race hurts or helps. Wayne Budd, the Black Republican, is one of those who believes Patrick's race helped him, even in a state still wrestling with its conflicted racial history. For him to be successful as our governor, he has to take on not shades of Black, but he's got to be the governor of everybody, said Budd. So he has to get beyond the race question. He has to be sensitive to it, and he has to be responsive to it, but his overall image has to be that of our governor. And if I'm Irish, if I'm Italian, if I'm Jewish, if I'm whatever, he's still my governor, and I can identify with him. Easier said than done. The minority community in Massachusetts may not be very large, but it is vocal, especially in Boston. The Black Legislative Caucus was impossible, one Patrick supporter told me. They were so difficult, so demanding. They now had their guy. They wanted access. But I just found some of their approach with him unreasonable. It just kind of boils my blood. Still, as governor, Patrick had the job of picking up dropped balls. Former Governor Mitt Romney's administration never followed up on a pledge to explain why minority drivers were pulled over on state roads in disproportionate numbers. Activists wanted to know what the Black governor would do about it. We have an African-American governor in the corner office. I would like to think our law enforcement personnel would recognize that times have changed, said one. Some of the challenges laid at Patrick's feet would normally fall to municipal officials. But when race was a factor, Patrick was a factor. In late 2007, when 13-year-old Stephen Odom, a Black boy, was shot to death on his way home from playing basketball, all eyes turned toward Patrick. Why hadn't he stopped the violence? Why hadn't he paid prompt respects to the boy's mother? No one had asked this of previous governors. The difference was that Patrick was being held to a new standard, one dictated by his race. Some of those critics, however, worried about Patrick for reasons that had little to do with race. When Patrick supported a Massachusetts law that legalized same-sex marriages, some socially conservative Black pastors ended up siding with some of the governor's fiercest critics, the state's dwindling collection of conservative Republicans. I had to explain to my grandson the other day why it's not okay for boys to marry boys, groused David Turk, who runs the Beacon Hill Institute, a conservative think tank. I don't want to have that conversation with my grandson. And I don't want to have a national health care system and a Canadian health care system. I don't want to surrender to Al-Qaeda. Compared to that, race is a non-issue. Patrick agrees with Turk on little else other than the idea that race should be a non-issue. The challenge, in my view, is not about the right versus the left, he told students at Brown University. It's not about race or gender or ethnicity or religion. It's a challenge of citizenship and the need fearlessly to reclaim American ideals. Like so many other breakthrough Black politicians, Patrick does not fit society's stereotype of how a typical Black man looks and behaves. A Harry Potter fan who snapped up three copies of the final installment in J.K. Rowling's series of books, he is happy to note that he and Harry share the same birthday. But he appears untroubled by the balance beam he treads daily, proving his Blackness to his own minority community while not allowing that same race consciousness to alienate the majority. In so much of the work I've done, I found that you had to put people at ease on the question of race before you could even start to talk about what you were doing, Patrick said. I don't fit a certain expectation that some people have about black men, and I don't mean that as anything other than an observation about my life. That said, it can be fun to be governor. The Red Sox mascot, a huge Kelly Green fuzzball in a red and white jersey, nicknamed Wally the Green Monster, comes to your events. The state trooper patrolling the halls has a Hail to the Chief ringtone on his cell phone. And the potential for history-making plays out on the mild yellow walls of the anteroom leading to the governor's office. There, giant oil paintings of living former governors stare down at visitors. Jane Swift, the only woman, is wearing a shapeless black suit. An odd sepia-toned abstract of Michael Dukakis, who ran for president and lost in 1988, is portrayed in an equally shapeless brown suit. Bill Weld, the patrician Republican, is in blue jeans. But will ambition and reality collide? 1 year after Patrick took office, the Boston Globe gave him only a middling grade for his ambitions. Mission accomplished, it is not, Globe columnist Steve Bailey lamented. I'm learning fast, the governor assured the state's leading newspaper. Good, the editorial assessment responded, because graduate school is over. On a side table in Doug Rubin's office rests a silver-framed campaign night photo inscribed with the words, Together We Did, an updated version of Patrick's Together We Can campaign slogan. Rubin is one of the true believers who are convinced that Patrick's success depends on the governor's willingness to push back when he has to. There were a long list of pundits in the state who said, You can't win. Who is this guy? He can't raise the money. He's never going to be successful. He can't organize, Rubin recalled. But he'd kind of blown away all of their kind of political wisdom. I think there were a lot of people looking for him to fail. Stephen Crosby, who did his own stint in state government as Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governors Paul Cellucci and Jane Swift, believes Patrick missed his chance to truly govern as an outsider. Those branding mistakes, the curtain, the car, followed by the book deal and his inability to ever take responsibility for it, Crosby said, ticking off the early missteps. He believes the problem is the press, that the press does not let him ever focus on the issues that matter. I think he's one serious mistake away from an indelible brand. It remains an open question whether Patrick will be strong enough to seek a second term without drawing a significant challenge. People are making a mistake if they are presuming there is a trajectory here that is clear and defined, Charlie Baker told me. I think it could go in either direction. For now, the governor is content to look east, as far as the Boston neighborhood of Dorchester, where he was struck one day by the expressions on the faces of the children at a school he was visiting. I looked up, and outside the window are a dozen or more of these little black faces. They're about this big, he says, gesturing. Backpacks on, they're all beaming and pointing and waving and everything. The governor's eyes are gleaming. When I look at the excitement in their eyes, it's not for the history we made. It's for the history they might make. That's what they're excited about. They see a possibility they might not have seen because I'm in this job. Chapter 10, The Next Wave. We look different, we sound different, and what's so striking about the way in which the old guard responds to us is that they don't quite know what to do with us, and we don't quite know what to do with ourselves either. Eddie Glaude, Jr. A group of young, gifted, black, and increasingly impatient politicians, artists, and academics were standing backstage at talk show host Tavis Smiley's sprawling State of the Black Union Conference in 2006. Lined up in the order in which they would eventually be introduced as emerging leaders, they fidgeted and chatted among themselves, killing time as they waited their turn. Waiting their turn was something most of them had been doing their entire lives. 35 speakers with varying levels of notoriety were scheduled to take part in hours of panel discussions. At the moment, the stage was occupied by the civil rights lions, including Louis Farrakhan, Al Sharpton, Cornel West, and Harry Belafonte. As the oldsters waxed on, the younger folk backstage began to murmur among themselves. It occurred to more than one of them that the big-name civil rights veterans preening in front of the C-SPAN cameras were perhaps lingering on stage a bit too long. A writer for a blog called One People's Project later captured the mood. The younger leaders, the blogger wrote, were unfortunately given short shrift since long-winded speeches and CPT, colored people's time, delays meant little time was left when they finally got their chance. This was a minor thing at its root, but as good an example as any of a recurring and familiar conflict in the Black community, in which rising stars are forced to temper their ambitions and egos out of deference and respect to the leaders who broke through first. The NAACP's Ben Jealous remembers a similar scenario playing out during the 1993 March on Washington for Jobs, Justice, and Peace. There were two stages, the historically powerful Lincoln Memorial Podium and what Jealous and others called the Kitty Stage on the grounds of the Washington Monument. Everybody was talking about time to pass the torch, time to pass the torch, said Jealous, who was a 20-year-old AFL-CIO organizer at the time. It didn't sit well with me. Instead, Jealous listened to the words of one of the older speakers, civil rights activist Julian Bond, who had gotten wind of the discontent and was speaking on the main stage. If you perceive that I have a torch that represents power and you want it, Jealous heard Bond tell the crowd at the march, you shouldn't be asking for it. You should snatch it. As power shifts begin to take root in local, state, and national politics, a fraught and delicate relationship has sprung up between the past and the future in the Black community. Armed with their college degrees, their private sector backgrounds, and their own ideas of how to gain and hold on to power, these young leaders are often finding that the biggest hurdles to leadership exist at home. Barack Obama's rise has affected many of their budding careers, rendering many of their ambitions more plausible. But they are not solely an Obama generation. Some are older than he is, and many have been laboring in the political vineyards for decades. Some of these people had the courage to step out there even before Obama said he was going to become a candidate for president, said Cleveland Sellers Jr., the veteran civil rights activist whose son is a member of the South Carolina state legislature. Still, the network of political relationships Obama cultivated within the African-American political class during his campaign provides a useful guide to the next wave of Black political leaders. It becomes instantly clear that this new breed is not defined by birth date as much as by their ability to stake claim to another tier of political power. There have been Black mayors, legislators, and elected law enforcement officials before, but the ones I profile in this chapter represent the broad swath of African-American political talent that has quietly taken root in city halls, state houses, and Congress just within the last decade. And if the past is any guide, their success is likely to spawn yet another new generation of Black political leadership as well. San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris. When Kamala Harris, 44, decided to run for San Francisco District Attorney, she came armed with a policy theory and a political plan. She would redefine the traditional idea of a law and order candidate by pointing out that the people who suffered at the hands of criminals often looked just like her, Black and female. I come from a background where law enforcement was not necessarily our friend, she says, and the heroes for me growing up were the architects of the civil rights movement. To do this, she had to win over an overwhelmingly liberal constituency more likely to be suspicious of law enforcement than supportive of it. She would even have to win over her own mother. My mother said to me when I was running, "You be careful, because when people close their eyes and think of who can keep them safe, and who holds these types of positions, it's not you." Indeed, with her lustrous shoulder-length hair, chic suits, and heels, Harris, who became the first female and first African-American to hold the job when she was elected in 2004, is more glamorous than gritty. But she likes to point out that as the city's chief law enforcement officer, she now carries a big old badge in my purse. Harris's mother was not trying to impose limitations on her daughter when she gave her this advice. She was just warning her daughter that change is hard. Shyamala Harris, a native of India, is a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Kamala's Jamaican-born father, Donald, is a professor emeritus in economics at Stanford. Her sister, Maya Harris West, is the Stanford-educated executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Northern California chapter. Breakthrough achievement was never the problem in this family. When I grew up, my parents were actively involved in civil rights. That's how they met and got married, she says. They were protesting, and I was protesting too. I was in a stroller, but I was there. A graduate of Howard University and Hastings College of Law, Harris has confounded expectations at every turn in her career, including in her effort to transform the district attorney's office in San Francisco. When she took over, there wasn't email, voicemail, or caller ID. Computers and telephones were shared. There was one copy machine for 200 people. But the bigger hurdle, she discovered, was changing attitudes about getting tough on crime. We've got to get out of this dynamic of simply asking the criminal justice system two questions. Are you tough on crime or are you soft on crime, she says. Instead, we have to ask, are you smart on crime? The key, she said, has been to speak to her community in a manner that redefined what law enforcement's role should be for urban dwellers who were as likely to be victims as criminals. They are poor, she said. They are people of color. They are vulnerable people who need a voice that treats them with dignity in the system. We do want law enforcement. We just don't want excessive force, she tells her audiences. We don't want racial profiling. We do want public safety. We just want proportionality and fairness, because the way that the African-American community talks about the criminal justice system, it gives the impression that we just want to open up the jail doors and let everybody out. As the first public official in California to endorse Obama in 2007, she was also co-chair of his California campaign and a member of its national leadership team. There is something about who he is and what he does and how he has done it, she said. But the other part is our country and how it has come along. Harris, who was unopposed in her 2007 re-election bid, doesn't mind being called a first, and she minds only slightly being branded a female Obama. Such labels, she concedes, come with the territory, even though San Francisco also has women in charge of its police and fire departments. There is something to be said for being the first in terms of breaking the stereotype of who can do what, said Harris. It's not because you're the first person that could do it at all. It's just everybody's ability to imagine who should or can do what. At the same time, Harris has come up with a handy answer to one of the most common questions she received when she took over as district attorney. They would ask me, well, what does it feel like to be the first woman, she said, laughing over lunch at her regular table at the Four Seasons. I said, well, you know, I've always been a woman, so I don't really know. But then I would say, but I'm sure a man could do it just as well, right? At that moment, she sounded just like Colin Powell. Not all rising stars choose elective politics for themselves. Harris's own family provides as good an example as any. Her sister's husband, Tony West, the prosecutor-turned-defense attorney, ran for office 8 years ago and lost. The best candidate to have never won a race, in his words. Now he is content to work the levers of political power from the sidelines. All three traveled to Iowa to campaign for Obama, spending their New Year's holiday canvassing for votes. West watched his sister-in-law try to convince elderly black citizens to come out and vote. It was almost heartbreaking to watch Kamala talk to this woman through the crack of her door, trying to convince her that this is possible, he recounted. And the woman just kept saying, you know, baby, that's not going to happen. You know he can't get elected. No black man can get elected. It was unbelievable. Well, believe it. California Assembly Speaker Karen Bass. Karen Bass never planned to run for elective office. Like Barack Obama, the Los Angeles Democrat started as an inner-city community organizer. Unlike him, she says, she harbored no unrealized political ambitions. But politics found the 55-year-old Bass perhaps as early as the age of 14, when she started knocking on doors for Bobby Kennedy. Now, as the first African-American woman to become Speaker of the California State Assembly, Bass sees her life as a full circle. There's a whole group of us in the L.A. area around the same age range who have all been activists since we were teenagers, she told me. All of us came out of the Vietnam War time, out of the Black Studies time. It was post-civil rights, but we were influenced and our values were set by the civil rights movement. Only 4 years after winning her first elective office, representing Los Angeles and Sacramento, the former physician's assistant rose to become one of the state's most powerful lawmakers. Republican California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is married to Bobby Kennedy's niece Maria Shriver, joked at Bass's inauguration that they had something in common. Both of us were told by Kennedys what to do, he said. The only other woman to lead either house of the state legislature, Republican Doris Allen, was recalled from office after only 3 months in 1995, so Bass has already exceeded that record. The most famous African-American breakthrough in California was, of course, Willie Brown, who was elected Speaker of the Assembly in 1980, before going on to become mayor of San Francisco in 1996. Brown, in his book Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times, summed up the challenge for African-American politicians as well as anyone. The fact of the matter is that as a Black politician, you're constantly having to spend energy to integrate yourself into the minds of white power brokers as a real, pure force of politics, he wrote. You also have to spend as much time reintegrating yourself into the Black community. Bass and Brown are not that much alike. As flamboyant as he was skilled, Brown spent the bulk of his political career creating and maintaining his Northern California power base. Bass only arrived in the state capitol in 2004 after founding a nonprofit group, the Community Coalition, designed to address the crack epidemic that ravaged families in her L.A. neighborhood in the 1980s. Term limits will force her to give up her seat in 2010. In the meantime, she is using her perch to wrestle the state's budget into shape. Governor Schwarzenegger, in an interview with a newspaper columnist, decried term limits. Look at Karen, he said. As leader, it's her first budget. I mean, poor girl, she gets thrown into this. It makes it very, very difficult when people start from scratch all the time. But Bass has built a career working on causes large and small, from limiting the number of liquor stores in South L.A. to establishing protections for the state's 80,000 foster children. Perhaps she will run for Congress when term limits force her to leave Sacramento. Perhaps she will not. Bass threw her ardent and early support to Obama, appearing on stage with Oprah Winfrey and Caroline Kennedy on the day Shriver made her own surprise Obama endorsement. And when Obama returned to California for a glittery Hollywood fundraiser designed to bring Hillary Clinton's disappointed stars back into the fold, it was Bass who introduced him. Although Obama is younger than she, Bass says she feels a kinship with him, one rooted in the statistical improbability of their respective achievements. I feel bad for him in a way, although it's the same position I was in, she said shortly before Obama won the general election. 24 hours after I was sworn in, I had to jump into the middle of this economic crisis, which a few months ago felt like it was just California. Now it turns out it's an international meltdown. Bass, like many women who rise to power, has found gender to be a greater hindrance than race. Her male colleagues, she said, were really knee-deep in questioning my ability to be strong. But I'm used to that, and I'm used to being a woman in leadership dealing with sexism. It annoys you, but you know what it is, so you don't allow it to confuse you or create doubt or compromise your confidence. By all accounts, she has charmed her colleagues with competence. But race, she hastens to acknowledge, presents its own challenge. When I asked her whether Obama's success meant the country had arrived at a new race-neutral plateau, she replied, I don't believe there is a race-neutral moment in the United States. The state's potential $20 billion budget shortfall made race and gender subside as Bass's primary tests. On the day she took office, she told the celebratory crowd, we have to respond to the current economic crisis the way we would a natural disaster. head-to-head in Atlanta. There is probably no other state, county, or city in America where black politics runs as wide or as deep as it does in Atlanta, Georgia. The city's connection to the civil rights movement is so deep and tight that it is nearly impossible to find a black elected official today who does not claim a political lineage full of figures from the history books. City Council President Lisa Borders, 51, keeps her history on the wall of her City Hall office in the form of a huge, blown-up photograph from her baptism. The presiding cleric is her grandfather, the Reverend William Holmes Borders, who pastored the city's historic Wheat Street Baptist Church for more than 50 years. It was at her grandfather's church that she first met Maynard Jackson, later Atlanta's first black mayor. And it was then, at the age of 11, that she decided that she, too, would be mayor someday. Maynard was my inspiration to politics, she says now. My grandfather was my motivation. Her ambition places her on a collision course with another rising star of Atlanta politics. State Senator Kasim Reed won his first election to the State House of Representatives 10 years ago, at the age of 28, and has since moved on to the state Senate. He managed both of Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin's campaigns and last year played a part in persuading Franklin to break with Atlanta's black political establishment and endorse Barack Obama. He, too, has acquired the bug for municipal politics. Each is a first. Each longs to break through once again. The 2009 race for the open mayor seat will be the test. In spite of her grandfather's accomplishments, Borders was discouraged from running for office. It was my community, our community, who said, "You can't win. What are you doing? You're not in the machine," she told me after chairing a council session on water rates. "When I asked permission, I didn't think they'd say no," said Borders, who won the special election and then a full term the following year. "And even when they said no, it was kind of like, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. The expectation was that I would fail." After first pursuing a corporate career in real estate development, Borders turned to politics in 2004 when she ran in a special election for the recently vacated city council presidency. She declared her intention to run for mayor a scant 3 years later. Her corporate background, she said, shapes her thinking as much as the civil rights history she grew up with. "It's not that there's still not a room and a place for protests in the street, because there absolutely is," she said. "But I think that the venue primarily has moved from the streets to the suites. And I think most of us who have been blessed and are beneficiaries of the civil rights movement now have not only a responsibility, but an obligation to figure out now what's the next platform." But before she can get to the next platform, Borders has had to cope with suspicions within her own community. Because her storied grandfather was a Republican, opponents have suggested she is as well. Not a good thing in overwhelmingly Democratic black Atlanta. She is a Democrat. Because she is single, some have questioned her sexual orientation. She's straight and divorced mother of a son. But most of all, Borders fights against the notion that she is an outsider. With her private school education and fair skin, she finds that white people tell her she is not really black, but black people do too. "Let me have my Cosby moment right here," she says, getting worked up as we talk about the questions raised about her in her own community. "You told me to go to school, get my education. You told me to pay my bills in full and on time. You told me to give back to the community. You told me to raise my child. I did everything you told me to do, and I not only did it, I didn't meet but exceeded your expectations. Exactly where did I lose my blackness?" She leans back in her chair. "And I said it in a debate. You could have heard a pin drop." Kasim Reed, who earned his undergraduate and law degrees at historically black Howard University in Washington, is a partner at a big Atlanta law firm. Perhaps because he is dark-skinned where Borders is fair, he is more sanguine about the identity question. "Every serious public figure that I know is going to go through some form of hazing on and test of their blackness," he told me. "I go through it, but the community, I think, brings you home." Reed says he was almost brought home in 2002. He was riding high after Mayor Franklin's election, helped run her transition team, and had been elected Legislator of the Year. The last thing on his mind was that he would have to worry about his own re-election. But then he ran into a constituent at a grocery store in his Southwest Atlanta neighborhood who scolded him for failing to spend enough time in the community. She told me that if I didn't start going to baptisms and ball fields and sitting with people, they were going to bring me home, he said. He plans to apply the lesson he learned then to the next mayor's race. In a city that elected its first two African-American mayors, Maynard Jackson and Andrew Young, by driving up the black vote, the formula has shifted, and it is not only because white voters have returned to the city. It is also because the civil rights babies are planning to follow the path established by the presidential candidate both Borders and Reed crossed the old guard to endorse, Barack Obama. You build coalitions, Borders says. You have to build coalitions and have enough ambassadors on your behalf that can be in all of the different spheres of influence across the city. White, black, short, tall, gay, straight, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, whatever. Reed agrees. I'm not going to be the mayor of the black community, he says. I'm going to be the mayor of the whole city, or I would just go and do something else. But this is still Atlanta, and both would-be mayors are careful to pay their respects to the ones who paved the way. Reed, for example, says his ambition would not have allowed him to run against Representative John Lewis, the black Democrat who easily turned back a generational challenge in 2008. I would not dream of doing that, he said, because, to me, that would just be so disrespectful. I would not want to be the congressman who beat John Lewis. Also, judging by Lewis's substantial margin of victory, Reed probably would have lost. Borders, who also considers herself the popular mayor's close ally, sees the clash with Reed coming and has decided to plunge in, even though Franklin tried to encourage her to run for Congress or Georgia's Secretary of State instead. I'm only going to do what I want to do, and it's this tiny little thing called mayor, she said. That's all I ever wanted to do. Like many breakthrough politicians, Borders and Reed care about more than just their own political futures. Borders, the mother of a 26-year-old son, has come to realize that the generation that follows her has little use for traditional politics, something she hopes Obama's success will change. We've got to make sure that everyone gets a bite of the apple, she says. That's the bottom line, whether it's women, people of color, people that are physically challenged, whatever. Everyone gets a bite of the apple. And Reed is concerned about a gap he sees growing between successful African Americans, such as Obama and himself, and those who are still struggling. I am worried that there is a cadre of black people that are being taken and rocketed into a new place and that we're too distant from the rest of black people, he said. It scares me.
And that will do it for this week's audio from Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We have one session left. That will be next week. We will finish the book up and then we will move on. Our new book, which we will be starting, actually, I'm not even sure. I can tell you the new book that we will be starting is The Delectable Negro, which was the tie. Folks voted last time around, and there was a tie between Gwen Ifill and Delectable Negro, and that's a book that I've wanted to have on the book club for a while. Dr. Curry references it quite regularly. Grand book. That'll be the next book. However, we would be starting it in 2 weeks, but 2 weeks is the inauguration, and I have planned for a long, long time that we were going to be on the air for the day of the inauguration so that I can celebrate the Obama's departure as well as the arrival of President-elect Donald Trump. So I don't know if we will be still doing the whole program and assessment of what's happening 2 weeks from today or if we'll be starting Delectable Negro. But either way, if you all want to prepare, that is the next book that we'll be doing, Delectable Negro. That's it. If you have commentary that you would like to share on The Breakthrough this week's segment, the number 641-715-3640 and the code is 564-943. pound. Press star 6 if you have commentary you would like to share. Folks who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead. Thank you. I'll wait.
Much obliged, sir. Thank you. I'll be quick. So I don't think you knew you were not on, on mute, but I said the same thing when I heard that the wife passed out and then she disappeared from the scene to be treated for depression. I do not recall her name, but I think that that just speaks to what I was saying in the first, my first commentary about this Black political scene not being at all constructive for Black mental health. And it, I'm happy to hear, well, not happy, but grateful that Ms. Eiffel included something about what it does to the families as well. The term fair and fairness was used a couple times in this one. And I kind of got instantly sad when she said our quote unquote lions, and then she began to list like Jesse Jackson and Cornel West. And I just thought about all the other people who existed at the same time and who were attempting to replace the system of racism, white supremacy with a system of justice, who have been assassinated. And these are who we consider our lions, or who she's saying is our lions. There's no shade towards them. I just kind of made me sad to hear that. And this is just something that I've been paying attention to. Gus has mentioned it a few times about one of the ways that racism and white supremacy functions by making sure that non-white, specifically Black people, never get to be settled and be and establish roots and have longevity in a situation or a place or an environment. And the quote, this isn't Ms. Eiffel, but someone said it makes it very difficult when people have to start over all the time. And I just think that that's so true. As I look back on my own life and I watch other people and I pay attention more and I have a little bit more clarity, to, you know, being rooted and being still and being able to build is so important. And I can really clearly see how races have made it so that non-white people just don't have that opportunity to do that. And that keeps us constantly recreating ourselves or looking for opportunities or where we fit in and such. There's so much time spent on whether or not an individual is quote unquote Black enough. And I really would have appreciated Ms. Eiffel's defining of what that meant or putting it into context, historical, even if not the context of racism, white supremacy, if, you know, depending on how she would be looking at it, but just to flesh that out a little bit more and let's not leave it so superficial to where someone is not Black enough if they don't speak a certain way or not Black enough if they don't wear a dashiki. But to say that what that speaks to is the fear in the mass population of Black people, that particular Black people who are placed in seemingly positions of power are not actually out for the interest of those Black people. And I think that is something that's being spoken, that's being spoke to or towards when people say someone is not Black enough. It's like, you're asking for my vote. When you get in there, are you gonna forget me? Like, can I trust you to keep my concerns legit? Like, are you really gonna fight for me? And I think that is what quote unquote Black enough is kind of speaking to, but I can't pinpoint a space where Ms. Eiffel kind of puts her, you know, puts any emphasis on that or any fleshing out of it or any analysis or any historical context or anything like that. And I think that would have been helpful for folks who, you know, might be a little bit more confused and things like that, just to have given that and just, you know, let's delve a little deeper into it. It would have been constructive. Thank you. That's it.
Right on. Roz or some of the other folks have commentary?
Sure. Yes, I thought the previous caller had some brilliant assessments. And just to piggyback off of what she started off speaking on, I want to actually read the section because I think it's very important to hear those words. I think this is something, like you said, if she did write it and it wasn't some white person hunched over in the night typing it up and then had her name on it, found to be interesting. She said, "Breaking through has its costs. John Lewis was hit in the head with a brick at Selma. Vernon Jordan was shot, and families pay a price as well. Martin Luther King Jr.'s wife and children were threatened. Shortly after Patrick moved into the corner office on Beacon Hill, his wife, Diane, dropped out of public sight to receive treatment for depression. Quote, unquote, I fell out splat in front of the public," she told a Chamber of Commerce luncheon more than a year later. And what I find telling about this is the fact that when you attempt to do anything as a black person, a victim of white supremacy, especially in the realm of politics, which politics is basically organized warfare, and specifically they term it as nonviolent warfare, which I don't believe. It does have its violent wing, but in this aspect it isn't. But as far as the way that they tout regular politics, but I find it interesting that as black people attempt to make some sort of headway in the system of white supremacy in the area of people activity called politics, you get hit in the head with a brick, you get shot and killed. Vernon Jordan was shot. So it just means if white people don't do something to you to either kill you or hospitalize you or injure you in some form or fashion, then they get you epigenetically, which is what Mrs. Diane Patrick went through. It was being around these terrorists that made her so sick that she literally fell out splat, to take her quote, out in public. And I think we really have to think very heavily about how deadly just being in the presence of white people can be, and how much it can really damage not just your psyche, but just everything about your life that you hold dear can be severely just compromised just by being around them. And the atmosphere that they create for us to try and function within is just insane. For us to really try to, we have to get into a place of non-sanity to just try and function in a way that looks so-called civilized and so-called sane, because it's an insane environment. My phone is acting up and I can't see the text for me to go get my, find out, read, make my other point. So I'm going to mute for now. Hopefully I can get the page that I lost back up on the screen. Thank you.
For sure. While we're sifting through other callers and such, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, do you all have a commentary you wanted to share as well? They might just be listening that this time around. That's fine as well. As we're waiting, I'll get in some of my notes quickly before we get to the end of the program. I thought that was great in terms of black mental health for Diane Patrick, Deval Patrick's wife, and the depression that she endured. The system of racism, white supremacy, does take a toll on black people in a myriad of ways. Let's see, continuing. The Wall Street Journal also piled on, declaring Patrick a pedestrian liberal governor who is remarkably quick to retreat in face of pressure from the status quo. I could read that to be white people. First thing that came to mind, number one, the Wall Street Journal, Rupert Murdoch. That is like Fox News in print. You can observe their treatment of Obama's time in the White House. Also, they are criticizing former Governor Patrick for, I guess, being quick to retreat when he is criticized or faces white opposition. If he said, I don't care what these crackers got to say about nothing, and I'm the governor of Massachusetts, and I pimped my ride out, and what you got to say about it? Man, if he did that, what would they have to say then? That's about what you can expect in the system of racism, white supremacy. Let's see, moving forward. this is a direct quote from Deval Patrick. He says, I'm new, I'm brash, had a big political victory in terms of the numbers against a lot of odds and most expectations, he said, and nothing wears worse than the appearance of being arrogant. It could be me, I could be in error. I don't remember having a whole lot of white people, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, George Bush, Mitt Romney. I just don't remember white people having that, Sarah Palin, having to answer these types of questions about, you're coming across as being a little arrogant. You know, you're coming across as being a little cocky, a little uppity. I just don't think white people have to endure that. It's only niggers where it's, hey, niggers getting a little uppity here. He's talking like he's got an education or something that have to respond to this. Let's see. She did include, she added a little bit, and I do mean a scant amount of historical context, where she talked about Michael Dukakis and the rape scandal that would have fit in very nicely when we did the whole breakdown of Harold Ford Jr. And what came up with Deval Patrick in the last chapter. I still assert Charles Stewart, that should for sure have been included as well. That's even more recent than some of the other things that she added. In fact, that Charles Stewart incident is right around the same time as Michael Dukakis. That one and the same, in my opinion, those two put together. And even her kind of glancing over the school incident, I used that photo of Ted Landsmark, black male, and this is 1970s in Massachusetts, where he got speared with the American flag because whites did not want niggers going to their school. And they came out and said that specifically. I played that clip as well, where they have the archival footage of whites coming out and saying, we do not want these niggers in school with us. If you all make us do this, we're going to pull our white children out. You're going to let the niggas have it. They said they have archival footage of white women coming out and saying this, and yeah, right on, tell them, sister, being cheered on by all the white Bostonites. Continuing, let's see. Yet, like I said, this notion, it's only black people. That's another point I would take. In this text, it seems to be greatly minimized when white people are coming out and doing things deliberately to sabotage black people. It seems to be minimized. The focus seems to be way heightened on black people scrutinizing or squabbling with other black people, which is standard in the system of racism, white supremacy. But she's talking about the quote unquote black community in Massachusetts, and she's already stated you don't even have that many black people in Massachusetts on the whole. It's 7% of the population. So it's not like you're talking about tons of black people, and this is not a power broker group. It's not like these folks got, you know, mines of diamonds and gold and wealth, and they're making decisions about who's going to be governor. That's not what we're talking about at all. Where she says these small number of black people and non-white people may not be very large, but they're vocal, especially in Boston. The black legislative caucus was impossible. One Patrick supporter told me they were so difficult, so demanding. They now had their guy. They wanted access, but I just found some of their approach with him unreasonable. It just kind of boils my blood. I just don't see that type of frustration consistently with the way whites terrorize black people in all areas of people activity. It keeps coming back to these black people who have no power. How are you so upset and your blood boiling with this small group of people? What are they going to do? Do they have the ability to repossess the pimp mobile or anything else that Deval Patrick was doing? Continuing, let's see. Race doesn't matter. This is a little bit later where she says Patrick agrees with Turek on little other than the idea that race should be a non-issue. It just seems like that's the approach that you're going to have to continue to come out and say, to continue to appease racists, downplay white supremacy as a problem. Maybe it was a problem in the past, but it's not a problem now. And she talked in the first audio segment about Deval Patrick having this photograph of one of the former governors in Boston who was a part of having the 54th Regiment, John Albion Andrew, in Massachusetts, where he got niggers to go fight in the Union Army, so he should be revered. Almost sounded like the worship of John Brown that I was mentioning earlier this week online. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure that I get in? Where she mentions a criticism. She writes, Stephen Crosby, who did his own stint in state government as Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governors Paul Cellucci and Jane Swift, believes Patrick missed his chance to truly govern as an outsider. I have no idea what that term means in the context of white supremacy. You are never operating outside of that system. So I have no, I mean, I don't even know if that's what this person meant, but that also should not be applied. It just doesn't make sense. President Obama, anybody else that you can think of, it's not like they can just come in and say, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And, you know, it doesn't matter what these white Democrats or white Republicans or white independents or white people, period. It doesn't matter what they think. That is, I mean, that's just nonsense of the highest order. let's see. Flip the page. And again, as I said, it's really playing up this conflict between black people. She says later, this is in chapter 10, the next wave, where she says she's talking about younger leaders. Oh, she referenced Julian Bond, Cowbell, where she says young leaders are often finding that the biggest hurdles to leadership exist at home. This notion that black people questioning your blackness or saying that they don't think you have a chance to win. When she mentioned President Obama and black people going out to campaign for him in Iowa and they didn't think he could win. Oh, man, black people just make it so hard. They don't believe and just won't support you and question your blackness and all of this. And I mean that, like I said, to me, man, with all of the things that whites are doing to all of the people that are mentioned in this book and elsewhere, I cannot believe that we're focused, that the focus, that the major focus of the book is on these minor squabbles with other black people. Let's see, final things I wanted to get in. I was glad that she mentioned the complexion of some of the folks who came up in the last chapter of the book, specifically the first politician. Why is it taking my page so long to turn here? The first person that she mentions, I think Karen Bass. Oh, not Karen Bass. Sorry. Kamala Harris. That's who it is. The first person that she mentions, Kamala Harris, she is very, very pale. She is a non-white female, and in fact, she just won. They said this was another huge breakthrough because she just was elected to U.S. Senate, one of the few black female members of the Senate. But both of Kamala Harris, both of her parents are non-white, but she's very, very pale. I mean, she's lighter than President Obama if you look at some of her photographs online, but she's about to join the next session of the U.S. Congress. Let's see, what else stood out from her segment, or just the last chapter 10, and then we'll check in, see if anybody has anything they want to get in before we wrap. It seemed like when she was doing the quotes, doing the voice of former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, that she was doing a little accent trying to sound like him. I think people had noted that before, that it seemed like the only time that she was trying to take on a whole different sound or different tone was when she was doing the voices for some of the black people that she was quoting and giving voice to. Seemed like that was a slight deviation with that. And then, let's see, with Ms. Bass, Karen Bass, she is in Congress now. She's been there since 2010. She is not as pale as some of the other folks that we've mentioned with the same pattern, which she moved to the section on Atlanta. Number one, anytime I hear about Kasim Reed now, my mind goes back to, I think it was 2014, Atlanta that year. For people who don't know Atlanta, it normally doesn't snow very frequently. The former Atlanta resident, when it snows in Atlanta, they lose their mind. Like everything is gone in the grocery store and people can't. I mean, it's crazy if you've ever been in Atlanta when it snows. It snowed in 2014 really bad. Kasim Reed was the mayor. Man, white people flipped. It was like they were blaming him, like, this nigga mayor made it snow, and he had to go on CNN. Their headquarters is in Atlanta, so he's on CNN, and this white woman is grilling him and talking. Kareem Reed came back. It was great. I played it on 2014. He showed so much black self-respect, like, wait a minute now, y'all are not gonna talk it like it's my fault, like I made it snow. Yes, we can go out and we can get the snow up and help citizens and all that, but I mean, come on, like, how much, I'm glad you all think I'm so omnipotent, but I mean, really? Did I put the snow on the ground? Did I make it so this is an area that we don't have snow often, so we're not adept at snow removal? And you can skip all of that. That's why I keep saying that the problem is white people. The focus should really be on them. There was a phenomenal piece written at this time by a black journalist. And she pointed out people were complaining because the traffic was really bad and people abandoned their cars on the interstate in Atlanta for people who've traveled. They had bad traffic anyway, but with the snow and everything, it was about a million times worse. It was terrible. People talked about being stuck on the highway and it taking them like hours to get to their children. I think school buses got stranded in all of that. This black, I'll repost it. I posted it that year and I referenced it in my writing. This black female reminded this problem, white supremacy, is at the core because white people in Atlanta deliberately wanted MARTA to not travel. MARTA is the train station, public transit system in Atlanta. They did not want the MARTA train to be widely accessible because they did not want a majority Negro city. They didn't want black people to have easy, great, efficient public transportation. So the MARTA system down there is terrible. If it had been better, traffic would have been so much better. It would have been so much safer. People would have got home quicker, but that was not the case. They just sat around and blamed Kasim Reed as opposed to saying, oh, yeah, we wanted it to be like this. We wanted it to be bad transportation, so that's what we got in Atlanta. I will stop there. Roz, did you get it together to get your notes in?
Yes, I did. Thank you. And I was laughing when you were talking about the storm in Atlanta because I remember the cars were, and it wasn't even that much snow. But I remember people were going bonkers, and I was like, what in the world is going on down there? But being a native New Yorker, we get snow out the wazoo. So, but it was just, I remember that because I was laughing when I saw it on the news, and it was showing like, it looked like The Walking Dead. Everything was just parked. People didn't know what to do, and I was blown away. But yes, I did. One of the other things I wanted to bring up on she writes, but the Democrats in the state legislature put Patrick firmly in his place. He had, after all, leapfrogged over everyone else on Beacon Hill. And they quote him saying, I certainly know that I cut the line by running for governor. And I just thought about it, you know, no matter what you do and no matter how, quote unquote, successful you are in a system of white supremacy, niggas have to know their place and they have to be chosen to take their turn. They cannot take their turn as white people do. That's one of the main reasons I believe that Obama was selected. Like they knew they wanted him in that position probably decades before he ever even became senator, in my opinion. And to me, that was a great statement where he was discussing, quote unquote, leapfrogging and the Democratic Party checking him for overstepping his bounds as a black male in a system of white supremacy. The other paragraph says, I looked up and outside the window are a dozen or more of these little black faces. They're about this big, he says, gesturing. Backpacks on, they're all beaming and pointing and waving and everything. The governor's eyes are gleaming. When I look at the excitement in their eyes, it's not for the history we made, it's for the history they might make. That's what they're excited about. They see a possibility they might not have seen because I'm in this job. And that just mortified me because I think the term black and politician is an oxymoron. Black people have no power. We have no control. You just talked about white people blaming him for it snowing in Atlanta, blaming the black mayor. So, I mean, to me, just the whole idea, and that's what I mean when I say that the whole election of Obama for black people, in my opinion, was just cosmetic. White people were gauging us to see where our politics had developed to the point where it was past the cosmetics of just of the first black anything. And we fell for it again, and they took the pulse of black Americans. So, oh, yeah, we still got them in the same place we've had them for the last 500-600 years. So to me, just the whole idea of him thinking, him being a physical example for other for black children to look up to and say, I want to be in the same position as him, is like leading young lambs to slaughter because they don't realize what they're getting into in the system of white supremacy, that they have no power. No matter what they're elected to, they have to listen to more powerful white people. And if they don't do what those more powerful white people say, they'll be in big trouble. The last paragraph, excuse me, I want to touch on, says, by all accounts, she has charmed her colleagues with competence, but race, she hastens to acknowledge, presents its own challenge. When I asked her whether Obama's success meant the country had arrived at a new race-neutral plateau, she replied, I don't believe there is a race-neutral moment in the United States. And you always talk about the metaphors. What in the world is a race-neutral plateau? What is that? It doesn't. I mean, it sounds like a unicorn or something. It's something that doesn't exist. It's something that's made up to give this false impression that there is a such thing as a race neutral plateau. Race and neutral doesn't exist. And I agree with you. The metaphors are just out of control. Earlier in the text, somebody talked about Deval Patrick having a tin ear. And I looked that up, and essentially it just means a person who has a problem hearing musical tones and sound. But I was like, what in the world is a tin ear? The metaphors, I'm keeping an eye out for those because I'm finding them to be very, very important. And just like you say, the vast majority of the time, 99% of the time, they're not accurate. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. Folks, waited too late today to get your comment in. People putting their hands up at the last minute. Jadar 3, you'll have to make a note, and we'll get it in next week. I found the article that I was looking for. I posted it on my Facebook page. It is phenomenal. It's Snow Didn't Paralyze Atlanta, Racism Did. You cannot make it any more clear than that, unless you just want to say white people, which would have been great too, but phenomenal. It's great. I referenced it in my writing, and it's written by Tracy Thompson. Tracy Thompson, What Does Racism Have to Do with Gridlock? And she goes through, and also you can look at the interview that he did on CNN. It got lots of attention way back in 2014 when Kasim Reed was on CNN. He talked with Carol Costello. She looks like a white woman, suspected racist to me. And people were flipping out at him like, you know, why didn't you close the schools and buses were stuck out there and rah, rah, rah. I mean, because like I said, brilliant illustration of black self-respect. I'll post it again on Facebook. But he said, whoa, hold on before you all get all mad like it's my fault. You know, and CNN, again, headquarters in Atlanta, so all these people presumably live in the area that are working there. You know, like I know, I'm not in charge of whether the schools are open or not. The school board makes that decision. Now, if you want to get some of the school board officials on and, you know, take them over the coals about why they didn't close the schools or close it early or how they responded, fine. That's not my decision to decide, yes, schools are going to be closed today because it's going to snow or it might snow or it did snow, whatever it is. It was an incredible illustration. And again, for me, that incident, even though it happened after this book was published, right back to the core issue that you can apply to everybody that's been mentioned in this book under the system of white supremacy. These people, whatever you want to call breakthrough, they are not breaking through the system of racism, white supremacy. And I'm very comfortable in there. We'll pick up next week to wrap this up. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in. Thanks for the folks being patient. Again, we lost our internet signal a couple times earlier in the broadcast, but I think things have been smooth and problem-free for the last, I don't know, 2 hours or so. If you have questions, problems, if you have commentary that you want to share that we can read next Friday when we conclude, feel free to drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With, I think, captured everything, we'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will review the first week of 2017. Lots of things happened this week. Last week was a little slow in terms of news because of the holiday and everything. That was not the case this week. Lots to catch up on for the first week of the quote-unquote new year. Thanks to all the folks for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We, again, will encourage sobriety would be best. I really appreciated that. I think we heard it was Karen Bass, unless I've missed my guest here, where she talked about her efforts to get some of the liquor stores out of predominantly black areas in California. Sobriety would be best. Sobriety, and it was Karen Bass, cha-ching, South LA. Sobriety would be best. Continuing, I know the sobriety points and all that should be minimized now that we're through all the holidays. That does not mean that it's a good idea to be intoxicated, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, cigarettes, anything else, when you get behind that wheel. Even if you're going to be a passenger, even if you're going to be a pedestrian, you do not want to be intoxicated and have that be the day that you are confronted with Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers, badge or no. We really want to make sure that we have our brain computer functioning at optimal efficiency so that we can make phenomenal decisions, keep ourselves as safe as possible. The evidence clearly has shown that none of these narcotics are helping us neutralize the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned. Yeah.